And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to be talking about education. Senate Bill 1085 still banging around in the General Assembly. And look, at the end of the day, it's all about privatization, profitization, putting more money into the hands of the very few at the expense of the, well, my kids. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that parent-teacher conferences today. Not a happy camper, in my view. Also, the job numbers. Did the drilling, did it really create 200,000 new jobs? And is Tom Corbett the more jobs governor? Or is this just Arthur Anderson creative accounting at its finest? Also going to talk about the Medicaid expansion. You know, is what's going on with Obamacare, is the Affordable Care Act being thwarted by states like Pennsylvania who are refusing to expand Medicaid and to fix the problems that they had? We'll find out some of that. Also, the transportation bill passed. Surprised a lot of people. I was, honestly, I'm quite shocked that the Republicans actually got something done. Not thrilled with all of the outcome, but something did get done. We'll talk about that. And, you know, our pensions next. Glenn Grell has said that's the next on the agenda. Look, they raised fees and stole wages from workers to get a transportation bill. Why not steal the future from our teachers, cops, and firefighters? And also the big Iranian deal over the weekend. Going to take your thoughts, questions, comments on that. You keep hearing the fake news on Fox. This is all about Obamacare. No, this is about actually doing two things at once, something the Bush administration didn't do a whole lot of, unless it was war. I'm going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com, or email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. We were away most of last week, moving to a new venue, bringing our studio back here to one of our stations here back close to my house. It's going to help us move into the future. I'm looking forward to the coming year. Great expectations, great hopes. But we apologize for last week's delay. Just a whole lot of stuff going on all at once. I'm constructing a new area, new studio at home. Doing a whole bunch of stuff all at once, and it just said, you know what, let's stop, let's take a break, take a breath, get off the treadmill for a couple of days so that we do it right. And you make the right decisions, you make the right moves, and we can move forward, and that's what we did. So we apologize for being away for a couple of days, but I think it's going to help come long term. Anyway, I came into the studio just my head about to explode. I had parent-teacher conferences today, and I'm just trying to get my head around this as we speak. And look, to me, this is No Child Left Behind. This is the Bush administration's thumbprint on education in this country, the direction of education. You know, the thing is I remember talking about No Child Left Behind when it was going on, saying this, I'm not thrilled with. I'm not thrilled with this whole idea of standardization across the line and this whole concept of Common Core and all of the stuff that comes with all of this high-stakes standardized tests and constant testing. Constant. So I went in today, my wife and I went to parent-teacher conferences, and for my oldest daughter, we who's in sixth grade, you know, we sat down with her math teacher. And, you know, the math teacher didn't seem, I'm not going to say it didn't seem like she was prepared, because I don't want to be one of those people bashing on teachers. She's got a tough job, 100 students that she's got to be responsible for. I don't want to seem like, it's the system that I'm struggling with. And in the conversation, what kept coming up was the Common Core came up three times. Standardized tests seemed to be all we talked about. Had a cute little graph. Well, this is where she was at the beginning of the year, and if we took the PSSAs today, she would pass. I'm going, but she doesn't really know as much as I think she should. Oh, she has a fine grade. I go, what's her grade? B minus. I'm going, well, that's not a good grade. B-minus is okay. I mean, that's the barest of bare minimums that as a parent I expect out of my child. I mean, really, that's the bottom line. Your job is to go and get A's. Your job is to go and do the best you can possibly do. And when I asked my daughter on the way home, are you doing the best you can? You know, she said, well, I guess I could work a little harder. But what frustrated me is this whole push towards this test. And that's, I'm fixated on this. Because I don't believe you can test people into learning. I don't believe you can test people into critical thinking. I don't believe you can test people, especially these bubble tests. Because what was interesting is we had first gone to my son's second grade teacher in the morning, who I just adore. She said, you know, here are your son's test scores. She goes, I don't put much in them because it's not who he is. She said, you know, I think he's so smart that the tests bore him. And he still scored high enough to be, you know, at the higher end of the class and the higher end of the score, but not as well as either of us expected. And she goes, I think he's just bored with it. And he just rushes through it as fast as he can. He's always the first one done with all this stuff, just to get it done and be done with it. And these standardized tests don't really help educate. All they do, and this came out last year, and for those of you who listened to the program for a while know that this was the basis for me saying no more standardized tests for my kids, no more PSSAs, no more of these high-stake tests, came out of my oldest daughter play teaching to the younger two, saying, well, you know, if you don't pass this PSSA, you don't pass this test, we're not going to have any money for the school. And if there's no money, we're going to close the school. Now, understand, you know, my then 10-year-old got it, understood what the whole system was about. It's about the money. And if you can starve schools and you can starve districts, you can then privatize them. You can have these charters come in who evidently not so concerned about standardized tests and not so concerned about passing them because the money is going to flow. And as we see, bill after bill, legislator after legislator, especially on the right, on the political right, and you've got your Democrats as well. The charters, this newfangled idea, we're gonna privatize, has a lot of support. And part of me says, do they have to do these standardized tests? Are we grilling and drilling them to death? And it goes back to my view, my belief, that the best learning possible is hands-on, get your fingernails dirty, experiential learning. Not sitting filling in a bubble, not sitting doing multiple guess, but actually getting your hands into it. And I'm really very frustrated. I'm frustrated at this, not at the teacher, because look, the teacher is doing what the school district has laid out. And what I found very interesting is the math teacher is telling us, as we're sitting there, that there are gaps in the education, in the math curriculum, that they haven't figured out yet. There are areas in the math, the new math curriculum. I'm going, how much has math changed since I was in school? 2 + 2 has been 2, 4 for how long? For, I think forever, right? You know, how long does this stuff change? How often? But in looking at it, you know, I'm just sitting here in when the teacher's telling me that the curriculum that's being forced on them to teach my kids, that there are gaps that they don't even know, that there's a flow to it that they don't understand. Man, I'm struggling. I'm struggling to understand it myself because, you know, my wife and I, we came home and go, what do we do? Because neither of us walked away with a very good thought. My youngest teacher, we're on board. Yeah, things seem to be going well. In fact, my wife and I, we go in to the classroom fairly often to help wherever needed. You know, like I go and help with math or go do reading or whatever. I'm okay with it. I see what they're doing, and I'm okay with that. Now that my daughter's moved into middle school, it's like, you know, now you can't come in. Sorry, stay out there. And not that my daughter would want me. Not that she would want me to show up. But I look at this and I go, you know, at some point I got to have some faith in the people that are teaching them. And when the teacher tells me that they don't understand the curriculum that's been hoisted upon them, I'm struggling with the district. And, you know, I was talking to a friend who's saying, well, you know, you've got to go to the school board. You've got to start organizing parents to start taking this stuff back. And that's where my frustration is I don't know how many parents know. You know, I guess it's easy to walk in, sit down, do your 5-minute face-to-face with the teacher who says, oh, everything's fine. Your child's doing wonderful. On course. On course for what? To pass the Common Core that I'm not all that on board with? Is that all we're asking? Is that what our school districts have done? Is that what these school boards have done? Is that what federal legislation has done? I sure hope not. And if you're as frustrated as I am about this, let me know. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Because at some point, now look, this does not in any way, shape, or form at all make me waver from public education. To me, this just solidifies my belief that the public has to be part of the education. As I think about this, and as it's still rattling through my head, and I'm still working through what happened today. I'm still working through the next response. I'm still working through, okay, maybe it was just a bad day. Maybe it just wasn't articulated right. Maybe she was just in the mindset of, I just want to allay the fears of these two so that they won't go home and yell at their child. I don't know what the thought was. But as I look at it, something's got to change. And it's got to be putting more control back into the hands. When a teacher tells me that the curriculum is screwed up, that's not the teacher's responsibility. That's the district who hoisted that upon them. That's the administration. Those are the people at the top. Again, all of this stuff, and this is where the right-wingers get me. I'm not a huge fan of central control. And I'm also not a fan at all of privatization. And profitization. When we come back, we're going to talk with Brendan Murray. He's the Harrisburg School District Board member. Can I ask him about this? Ask him about Senate Bill 1085 and what's going on there in Harrisburg. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Not right wing. Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. To hear Republicans in Fox News tell it, the Affordable Care Act is the coming of the apocalypse for untold millions of Americans with private market health insurance policies who are getting all those cancellation letters due to Obamacare. The truth, according to a careful new report from Families USA, is very different. Families USA's Ron Pollack.
The net result is that only a very tiny portion of the non-elderly population, less than 1%, by our calculation, 0.6%, are at risk of losing their current individual health insurance market plan due to the Affordable Care Act. The overwhelming majority of people with private individual health insurance today will soon be able to receive better coverage and pay lower premiums due to the Affordable Care Act.
The Families USA report says 15.2 million Americans, 5.7% of the non-elderly population, have health insurance in the private marketplace rather than through
employer-based group plans. Pollack says these are often Swiss cheese policies with big holes in coverage. The report found that 10.8 million of these people are income eligible for Affordable Care Act policies. Pollack says that means they will get more affordable, better insurance under the Affordable Care Act, even if their current individual market policies are canceled. Put in perspective and in context, Obamacare benefits at least 90 million people, while just 0.6% of non-elderly Americans are at risk of losing unsubsidized coverage.
That number is a tiny fraction of the 65 million non-elderly people with pre-existing health conditions who will gain new protections through the Affordable Care Act. It is also a small fraction of the tens of millions of uninsured Americans who can also get help through new health coverage.
Registered nurses at Lawrence and Memorial Hospital in New London, Connecticut, say they won't be bullied by management threats to lock them out. The union nurses, represented by American Federation of Teachers Local 5049, say the lockout threat is just more of the same scare tactics from the corporation that runs the hospital. The 540 RNs and 250 LPNs want a new fair contract, including protections for patients and their families, as the corporation shifts services and caregiver jobs away from the hospital. The LPNs are members of AFT Local 5051. Both union locals have authorized strike action if necessary. The nurses say they hope to reach a mutual agreement, though, at the bargaining table without a strike. The nurses have filed unfair labor practice charges and have warned the hospital that a four-day work stoppage could begin as soon as Wednesday. As holiday gifts-giving kicks into gear, don't forget Workers Independent News. Listener support helps sustain this newscast. Donate now at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
By working harder and working smarter, working with the employees in the Commonwealth, we made state government the smallest it has been in over 50 years. Promise kept.
We who have nothing, and most likely will till, we all end up locked up in jail. By conservative Christian, right-wing Republican, straight white American man.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Yeah, locked up, and yeah, profitable, right? There's a lot of profit in locking people up. I guess it's better than giving them an education, or so it seems. The profit over people, that seems to be it in my view. Anyway, welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Let's go to the phone. I got Brendan Murray on the line, Harrisburg School Board member. Brendan, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me on, Rick.
You know, I look at this Senate Bill 1085, and I'm kind of in this flustered mode where I just had we just had parent-teacher conferences with my daughter's teacher, and I'm not thrilled with this idea of the Common Core. I'm not thrilled with this standardized tests. I mean, in a 10-minute, 15-minute conversation with my daughter's teacher, the words Common Core came up three times and PSSA came up three times. And I'm going, that's not why I'm here. I want to know how my kid's doing in school.
Yeah. I can understand your frustration because, I mean, we are on the same lines of I don't believe teach to a test. And I don't believe you teach towards, you know, any kind of a standardized situation. You teach to make sure that they understand the basics and that they're moving forward and they're progressing in their education.
Help me with this because, you know, I'm a huge supporter of teachers. It's a tough job. It's an important job. But when I have a teacher who tells me that the curriculum that it's been hoisted upon them has gaps that they don't yet understand, I kind of have a problem with that. Not from the teachers, from the teacher, but from the district who would choose a curriculum, from the administration who would put this in a situation where your people doing it don't understand. I'm struggling with that, Brandon.
We get hamstrung as a district that has to go by the core of what a different administration believes in. So when you get hamstrung, you have to do what you can to make sure that the funding continues in your district, because that's a huge aspect of things that have been continuously cut, and we've talked about that multiple times. So it gets to the point where you are doing exactly what they wanted, because if you don't do it, then they hold the funding over top of your head saying, well, guess what, we're just not going to fund your education in your district. Sorry, the money's not going to be there because You're not doing what we want you to do.
Yeah, I mean, I listen to this, and it's frustrating on so many levels. Because, look, like I said, I'm a huge supporter of teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And they are put in a position to where when I walked home, I'm going home, and I'm going, my head's about to explode. Because I know that this is part of that. We're going to set up a situation where the teachers don't quite know what's going on. The kids evidently aren't going to know either, and they're going to struggle on these tests. And I think it's all by design. And I'm not trying not to be conspiratorial, but at some point, what is, is.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, they've been trying to fund education for so long, and the way that they've now corresponded with it is, first of all, let's put as much money into charter schools and think that they're the panacea for everything. And then B, you know, let's go ahead and let's try to make it so hard for a student to get the standards that are needed so that the funding can be taken out of it. And just say, you know, instead of with No Child Left Behind and with everything that has been put forward with the conservative way of funding, it's very hard that if you are not doing everything exactly perfect to get the funding you are. And in fact, most schools are nowhere going to be near the progress that we were supposed to receive. I mean, we were all supposed to be at AYP scores at 100% by the time that this was all put through. There's no way a school is ever going to meet those standards.
That's any school. I don't care what school you're talking about. There's no school going to get, you're not going to get 100% on anything in this society.
No.
Or in this lifetime.
You shouldn't expect to be too. I mean, there's just no way that anyone's going to be completely and utterly perfect. It's just not possible.
So when you look at that, then the logical conclusion is by putting something like that in place, you obviously want to destroy it.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a longstanding thought process in the way that education has been going for the past, I'd say maybe 15, 20 years. And that is that, you know, teachers unions are bad, that we're only hurting our youth because, you know, these teachers want so much out of everything. So we got to destroy the unions that are involved with the education. And then secondly is that, you know, no one's really doing such a great job in education. So we're going to have to redo everything. We're going to have to make it charterized and profitized because that's the only way that anyone really seems to be motivated. And it's absolutely absurd. And that leads to the charter school bill that's coming forward. I mean, this charter school bill, I admit, has a few things in it that I would be hoping that they would put forward. However, it's so poison pill with so many different of these aspects. The one that catches me in unbelief is to take the right of a school board member away from them being able to decide whether or not they want a charter school in their school district. So you're going to tell the school board member that, you know, hey, A, we're going to take the money out of your district. B, it's going to go towards probably some corporation that is, you know, a business administration company that's going to be taking care of most of the money. And then C, you know, sorry, you're not going to get a choice of whether this happens or not. It's going to go to a local university that has no basis of an actual electorate. So there's no one accountable.
Yeah. What I had asked, and I've asked a number of people, if in looking at this, could it be one of these online universities? Because they're saying, you know, an institution of higher learning. Could it be one of these for-profit ones that we see that have horrible graduation rates, huge profit rates, but horrible graduation rates and horrible educational attainment? Could it be one of these for-profit universities who say, you know what? Because I've been saying for years, this is the model, it's coming, but I'm just throwing this out. Could it be that they have this ability and they start doing to K through 12 as they've done to higher ed, which is not much of a service, not much at the end of it, but huge profits for them and their shareholders?
Yeah, I didn't even really contemplate that aspect of things, to be honest with you. I was going from a local, you know, maybe a hack or, you know, Penn State, Harrisburg would be the ones. But to be honest with you, that is an astonishing fact that it could happen. I mean, any one of these, you know, I mean, what constitutes a higher learning of education, to be honest with you? I mean, do you have to meet a certain criteria?
It doesn't say that as far as I see.
No, it doesn't. And I mean, all right, so we also have foundations in our school district that the Harrisburg Foundation, they've done an excellent job of raising money for our school district, which we shouldn't have to have.
Nope.
I mean, we both agree with the fact that we shouldn't have to have a foundation to raise funds for public education. But we do. And this law would open the opportunity for a charter school to have a foundation.
Not only that, Brendan, we shouldn't have to have a foundation raise money, but we shouldn't have to be selling space on our report cards to financial institutions to get money to put into the schools. We shouldn't have to be selling advertisement on the side of buses. We shouldn't have to be doing a lot of the things we're doing. We should be just funding education at the proper rate. And look, if the Harrisburg Foundation wants to raise money, it should be for extracurriculars, to take that trip to the zoo or to the museum, or for extra things, not core function of education.
Absolutely, and you're right. I mean, and if you look at our budget in Harrisburg School District, it was estimated that it was 2 years before our budget this year, we spend about $6 million on charter schools, between the cyber charter schools and between the actual brick and mortar.
Wow.
It jumped this year to close to $13 million. So you're looking at a doubling every so often of this situation. Now, we are, with the Harrisburg plan that has been put into place with Mr. Gene Vino as the chief recovery officer of the plan, looked at every opportunity to try to scale back on new people going to charter schools and trying to circumvent this pattern that has been started to create it. So we would, it's starting to work. We're starting to get some of our students back, and yes, we have had to create our own little charter school with our cyber school that we have. But see, the benefits of that are that these are our teachers. The money doesn't leave the district. And yes, we have had to create this to make up for what has been a failed attempt at education in this corporate administration.
See, now what you laid out, Brendan, is where I agree with charter schools. They should be in the hands of the local public school under the purview of board members like you and citizens like me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's where it's working.
Yeah, that's where it's working. I mean, we right now, we had a presentation this past board meeting about our Cougar Academy. We have good students who learn better in that atmosphere and are succeeding. So, you know, that's based off the fact that they're given, you know, it's not going to cost us $9,000 to educate them and only pay out and end up or pay out, you know, $9,000 for them, but yet only cost the actual administration $4,500. So in the long run, if these students do work out better in these situations, absolutely I want them there. And absolutely, I want everyone that is better, it feels better off in a charter school, cyber charter school, to come back to ours. Because I guarantee you that our education, that our testing, and all of our scores are going to be much better off than the ones that we have from the ones that are going out there through the Pennsylvania charters that are out there now. So, I mean, it's a shame that, you know, there's that a bill that, I mean, there was a House bill that was going to go, that was made it through the House. Much better bill than this. But, I mean, there's still other things that are just absolutely absurd in here. You know, you can renew for a renewal. They'll allow you to go for 10 years without having to be a subject underneath any kind of board review, whether it be the Higher Education Board or our school board. Now, I don't know any institution that can go 10 years without some kind of a review and feel like they're absolutely on the right track.
Yeah. You know what? As I was reading through it and the information that I've gone through on this Senate Bill 1085, which I am absolutely opposed in its current form, But the one thing that really, really shot out at me, and we had talked a second ago about, you know, what charters were meant to be, and I believe they were meant to be the laboratories of innovation. They were meant to be, hey, let's try something a little different within the structure of public education. Let's maybe there are some kids who learn a little bit better with a much more experiential type learning environment, like kind of like a Montessori school.
Yeah.
And with public taxpayer dollars, we did that under the control of the school district. It's gone completely awry and completely away from that original vision. But this piece of legislation, Senate Bill 1085, actually removes the language that says that the charter schools would serve as models of innovation.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, just it says, you know, we're not even going to attempt to fool you into thinking that that was ever the goal. We're just going to take that right out. And now it's just, it is what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, anytime that you write the bill the way that it is written in this form, first of all, I met with Senator Teplitz in our district here. At a town hall meeting, I expressed my concern for this. He's on the education committee. He's fully against it. With all the different things that are in this bill that have good ideas and that are actually, you can't take the right of a school board away from the fact of the matter is that you're taxing them without representation. I mean, it's absolutely absurd to think that as I've witnessed seven different applications for charter schools, I believe at this point in time, I'm one of, you know, a few that could say that if a charter school comes up, I can tell whether it's going to be good or bad by the time the actual interview with the applicant is done. I absolutely believe that if you take that right away from the people in the area that they live, who are they supposed to complain to? It can't go to they can't go to the university or whatever institution of higher learning is going to be put in as the people who are, you know, going to be making these judgments and say, hey, listen, you guys screwed up. You put the wrong institution in. This charter school was much better than that one, and you let this one in and not that one. You can't say that to them. There's no board to go to.
And don't you think part of it is that reasoning? That we won't see the accountability, we won't see the fact that there hasn't been a cyber charter school that's made AYP ever, that we won't see the comparisons, that it just won't be there. So if it's kind of like out of sight, out of mind, if you don't know that it's failing, but it's got shiny doors and shiny knobs and it looks nice, that's all you're happy with.
Absolutely. I think that definitely could be one of their major objectives. The less that they have to see, you know, the failings of what has been going on in their plan here of taking over education, the better it is for everyone in their side. There are so many different things that this law brings up. I mean, even one of the things that we've seen in every single application is that they will always target one of our schools that have been closed. And it always seems to be, well, our solicitor is, who comes in to do these charter schools, a very, very, very good solicitor, and she does an unbelievable job specifically at charter schools. And she always asks the question, did you ask the school district you want the school? Or if they're going to give you the school? And every single instance, it says no. Well, in this law right now, they have the right of first refusal. So, all the schools that we have out there that we could possibly recoup some of the money that we need as a school district that we put money, time, sweat, and taxpayer dollars into isn't going to go to us. It'll end up going to a charter school wants to come in.
So could you then make the argument that this is just really – it could end up being just a land deal then?
We open up
a crummy charter school. We know it's going to flop. Nobody shows up. We've spent a bunch of taxpayer money because we've seen this happen in other areas, that it ends up closing up. And who gets the land? Well, the people who are operating the charter school because, well, the district handed it over.
And absolutely. And then what happens is then they can use it for any kind of anything they want. So, I mean, there's no limitations on what kind of takeover could eventually lead to, because we're looking at the schools that we've put $16 million in is one of the lowest amounts that we put in. And they have to write a first refusal. So, I mean, we couldn't possibly never recoup this amount of money that we need to. It leads itself to continuation of taking away from the public education funding and giving it to for-profit industries to do what they will with it.
Is there any hope of stopping this? I mean, really, I mean, it seems to me the moneyed interest, the institutional momentum forward, it just seems to me that it's almost insurmountable.
Well, I'll be honest. It's the last bit of legislation that this body will do this year, if they're going to do anything. And that's what we were told by Senator Teplitz. So if there is any way to call your senator, wherever you're at in this state, and make it understand that, you know, you don't want taxation without representation. I mean, that's one of the main reasons why we started this union all the way back. And, you know, we can't continue to pump money into education that has already proven itself to not work. So we have to figure out a way to start funding education in our areas as best possible. And the best thing to do is get behind your local school board and make them, first of all, aware of the bill, because some of them won't know. And it's unfortunate, but some of them just don't have the time to do the research. Get them to know that this is out there, that this could possibly affect them completely and utterly when it comes to their budget, so that maybe you can get more elected officials to start speaking up.
Well, it's something we absolutely have to do. And, Brendan, it's always great to have you on the program and enlightening us and giving us your perspective. I greatly appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Rick, for having me on. And I always appreciate being able to give you a little insight on what, you know, what I'm seeing from a board member's perspective.
I appreciate it. Our friend Brendan Murray, Harrisburg School Board member. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Listening to the Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
As we approach our annual feast of Thanksgiving, please join me in expressing our nation's deepest heartfelt feelings for an extra special group of America's farmers. That raspberry goes out to the 50 billionaires who've been farming the U.S. Farm Subsidy Program for years, harvesting a cornucopia of taxpayer cash for themselves or their corporate empires. The diligent watchdogs of the Environmental Working Group match their own farm subsidy database with the Forbes 400 list of richest Americans to unmask these Gucci-wearing old McDonald's. E-I-E-I-O, what a ripoff! Among the richest of these faux farmers are three Walmart heirs whose personal wealth totals $100 billion. Then there's investment huckster Charles Schwab, sitting on a $5 billion wad of wealth, yet pumping $500,000 worth of rice subsidies into his California duck hunting resort. Also, corporate takeover artist Henry Kravis, who has amassed some $5 billion in wealth, took more than $1 million from us to subsidize safflower, sunflower, and other crops raised on two of his ranches. Especially jarring is the presence of such multi-billionaire right-wingers as oil and entertainment tycoon Philip Anschutz and nuclear waste mogul Harold Simmons. They've expressed disdain for government spending on poor people and other, quote, takers, yet they've gladly taken more than $500,000 each in farm payments. Actually, the working group's tally understates the total haul by these mega-rich tillers of our public treasury. Many also harvest crop insurance subsidies. But Congress has dutifully outlawed disclosure of these names to the public, even though it's our money they receive. This is Jim Hightower saying, in fact, these billionaires' most profitable ag products are the Congress creditors they keep in their corrals. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
I am so pleased to be your governor, and I ask you to give me your support as I run for governor, because I am running for governor of Pennsylvania.
It'd be nice to see him run to South Carolina, to that house he bought that didn't bother him. Didn't bother. I didn't know I was supposed to disclose it. I didn't know I was supposed to do that, even though I was the top attorney for the state for a number of years. I was the attorney general. No, I didn't know. I didn't know. I had access to the best legal minds in the state. I had access to the people who oversee the Constitution of the state. Could have called the Supreme Court of the state of Pennsylvania and asked, hey, what do you think about this? Could have asked for some legal... No. I didn't know. Think about that for a second. I didn't know. Would it work for you or me, would it? Not at all. Anyway, welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Thoughts, questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick at therickssmithshow.com, or give us a call here at the studio, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You know, I look at this, and, you know, Brendan brought up a really interesting point. It's the funding. And if we just funded education at a level that you go, you know, acceptable. And here's the thing that gets me. And I was just having this conversation over the weekend. And I was talking to a friend of mine who's about 30 years older than I am. And we were talking about back when he was going to school, how there was like one high school. And all of the kids went there. The rich kids' parents had to send their kids there because there weren't private schools in every area. And for the most part, all of the socioeconomic classes came together in the same building. So, of course, the very well-to-do in the community, they didn't want the schools crumbling and falling down. They didn't want second-class services. They didn't want it to snow in classrooms when it snows outside. They didn't want kids to have to share books. So they made sure that the schools were adequately funded. But as we have split apart, as we have become... Well, as we've become two societies, those who have and those who don't, education has really taken that hit. And I look at an article written over at The Atlantic. They point out in 2010, the school district of Philadelphia spent, on average, about $13,000 per student on a population that's about a little over three-quarters poor. About a little over three-quarters of the people there in that district live in poverty. Then you just go a couple of miles away to the Lower Merion school district, a school district that has about 7% of the student population living in poverty. So you've got 77% in the Philadelphia school district living in poverty, 7% in this Lower Merion school district living in poverty. They spend $13,000 per student on the kids in Philadelphia, but $27,000 per student in the Lower Merion school district. It begs the question, who came up with this funding formula? It begs the question, are we surprised that the Philadelphia school district is then struggling? If you were to fund those kids in the Philadelphia school district at $27,000, which I don't hear anybody talking about, nor do I hear anyone saying that we should be funding the kids in Lower Merion at $13,000, it does beg the question of what is an adequate number? Is it closer to $13,000 or is it closer to $27,000? And for me, what we're doing now is trying to sink the ship so that we can find a cheaper way of doing it. And I know I've had people tell me, you know, Rick, you know, Democrats are in favor of charter schools. Democrats are in favor of especially in urban areas. And the response is pretty simple. Yeah, I mean, when your local school building is crumbling before your eyes, when things have been allowed to get so badly out of hand because you've been defunded, and when your principal is out opening doors to help kids find their classroom because you don't have the staff to do it, when you don't have nurses or librarians or counselors, when you don't have those things, is it any surprise that someone's going to go, well, we got to try something different because this isn't working? They're not saying this isn't working because the people aren't working their butts off trying to make it work. And they're not out there saying we need more funding. They're just going, something isn't working. So they've been offered this lifeline. Or so they think. Oh, that this is what we're getting. And this is going to solve our problems. It's like every silver bullet we've ever seen in the past. It's a silver bullet for someone. Someone's going to get rich, and someone's going to pocket a bunch. It's like when I was a kid growing up. Busing was the thing that was going to make everything wonderful. We were going to ship poor kids all over the city of Cleveland where I grew up, and they were going to get the greatest education. Turns out they got a worse education because they spent most of their time on the bus. And, oh, hey, if they missed the bus, they missed the day of school, because good luck getting a ride 2 hours to the other side of town. Again, to me, this smells of all of that. And you look at this Senate Bill 1085, which is just, there's so many things in it that I just cannot possibly stand with. Just, and when we come back, I want to talk about a couple of those things, because I'm still fuming over today, and I want to get some of that out before we get into the second hour. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You got a thought or a comment, right back after this.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
Somehow I had a memory of learning in school that our Thanksgiving holiday was established by the pilgrims that came over on the Mayflower. But I discovered that President George Washington issued the first Thanksgiving proclamation on November 26, 1789, and thus began the long and winding path to whether and when America would celebrate the holiday. It would not be until the year 1956 that a final unified Thanksgiving Day would be established. The early presidents after George Washington were not particularly keen on declaring Thanksgivings, mostly because it was perceived as a New England or a Yankee tradition, and many of the early presidents were from Virginia. So it became somewhat of a regional celebration. And then came along New England novelist Sarah Hale. If there is a mother of Thanksgiving, it would be Ms. Hale. Join me next time to find out the results of Ms. Hale's efforts to establish a Thanksgiving holiday. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
On June 25, 1938, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Fair Labor Standards Act into law. Viewed as one of the final pieces of legislation of FDR's New Deal and the single most worker-friendly piece of legislation ever written, the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 was a victory not only for labor unions, but for workers, families, and children across the country. FDR called the new law the most far-reaching, far-sighted program for the benefit of workers ever adopted in this or any other country. This visionary piece of legislation put a ceiling over hours and a floor under wages, mandating a 44-hour work week, a 25-cent minimum wage, and time and a half for overtime. The Fair Labor Standards Act was later amended to 40 hours per week and 40 cents per hour. The law also excluded children from working dangerous jobs and set standard conditions for the employment of child workers to avoid continued exploitation of children. The Fair Labor Standards Act has been changed or amended at least 43 different times. These alterations have been used both to expand worker protections, such as raising the minimum wage, prohibiting age discrimination, and requiring equal pay, and to restrict and take away protections such as the Taft-Hartley Act and the 2004 Fair Pay Amendment. Today, we take the 40-hour work week, minimum wages, overtime, and child labor protections for granted. But up until the passage of the Fair Labor Standard Act, workers were at the mercy of their employers, and children were dying in industrial accidents. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
I've got a golden chance to make my way, and with a golden ticket, it's a golden day.
You know, that's really the thing. I mean, education to me is that opportunity. It is that one chance that I think you get to change your station in life, to give you that opportunity to explore and to open up. And, you know, I think back to myself, and, you know, I talk about this with my kids often. I didn't get the love of learning until I missed it throughout high school. It was not and I think a lot of it had to do with personal situations. My mother passing away and, you know, being raised by my grandparents and given complete and total freedom to do whatever I want, and I did. I think, you know, I missed that. And the beatings I took through Catholic school, which just made me hate school on a whole nother level. But when I went back to college, that's when it really dawned on me. And it was, you know, I was a little late. I didn't, you know, get my master's degree until I was, what, 44? Would have been nice to do that at 23, 24. Would have been a lot different. But, you know, I keep telling them, you know, now is the time to explore all of these things. Explore what's in front of you. And what's frustrating me is these tests just sucking that life out of them, sucking that exploration and that it's just so much to it. And I look at this Senate Bill 1085, which, you know, I hit on, and I was surprised because Brendan's usually up on, he's usually further ahead on this stuff than I am, because I'm just an outside observer in this. You know, the fact that you could end up with one of these for-profit universities, the ones that spend millions and millions of dollars advertising on TV that, hey, you can get your online degree and, you know, whatever, at home online and all that, how wonderful it is. And then you find out that their graduation rates are abysmal. Their profit margins are grand, but their graduation rates are abysmal. And most employers won't even take the degree seriously. So they've got no name, they've got no credibility, and they cost a fortune. And guess who's paying for it? Oh, yeah, you are, and I am. The tax dollars going to fund these things, especially through the GI Bill, through the roof. So then you look at the language of this Senate Bill at 1085 that says, well, you know, just an institution of higher learning doesn't say who, doesn't say it has to be local, doesn't have to say it doesn't have to be in the state or in the country, for that matter, can set up a charter school or a whole bunch of them. And in this Senate Bill 1085, it's going to give a charter operator the ability to consolidate these charters by having multiple charters that they can come bring together under an umbrella group. And then you wouldn't even need any local approval. So there's so much to this to me that just isn't helpful. There's so much to this that potentially dangerous, not just for taxpayers and our money, but for our kids. And I look at these years that my children have. These are the only years where they're going to have nothing to do but learn what's in front of them. Nothing to do, but this is their job. Their job is to fill their brains with the knowledge that's going to move them on and to become good citizens, good adults, the next generation of parents and caregivers, the important part being their caregivers, because you know what, I'm going to get old and I'm going to probably need one. That's why, to me, education is so important, so vital. And this tip of the nose, here and now, today, carpe diem type thinking, is flat wrong. And I think our society has done a lot of this. It's about the here and now. It's about right now. What can I see at this very moment? Instead of thinking long term. What's it going to do intergenerational? What are my kids and my grandchildren and their children going to do? What are we going to leave for the future? What's the legacy for them? My grandparents' generation understood it. They understood that the investments that they made in technology and infrastructure and society were paying dividends for the future. They understood that because they didn't want, and maybe this is a part of our problem, that we have been so far removed from the kind of disaster, the kind of misery and unemployment and poverty that my grandparents' generation do. Maybe we've been so far removed from that that we've forgotten what it's like. Maybe that's part of it. And as I look to the future, I keep going, what's tomorrow, what's the day after going to look like for my kids? Especially when you look at this piece of legislation, Senate bill, and I encourage everyone, call your legislator, call your senator, say, you know what, nuh-uh. Go back to the drawing board. Take some of this ugliness out of there. The idea that you're going to change the whole concept of why you started charters in the first place seems to me misguided, at best, criminal. The other part of it is a school district is going to have to pay for things that a charter school provides that your public school doesn't. Does that make any sense? And the example I've been giving is, Harrisburg almost didn't have kindergarten. But if the charter school in Harrisburg wanted to have full-day kindergarten, the school district who's not offering their public school students kindergarten is going to have to pay for full-day kindergarten in the charter school. You figure that one out, because I can't. Just mind-blowing on so many levels. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher on the smartphone. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally, and again, on this whole education thing, I would love to hear your inputs, thoughts. If there are any parents out there that had the same thoughts, I'd love to hear it. I'm going to take a quick break, right back with the second hour. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
To hear Republicans in Fox News tell it, the Affordable Care Act is the coming of the apocalypse for untold millions of Americans with private market health insurance policies who are getting all those cancellation letters due to Obamacare. The truth, according to a careful new report from Families USA, is very different. Families USA's Ron Pollack.
The net result is that only a very tiny portion of the non-elderly population, less than 1%, by our calculation, 0.6%, are at risk of losing their current individual health insurance market plan due to the Affordable Care Act. The overwhelming majority of people with private individual health insurance today will soon be able to receive better coverage and pay lower premiums due to the Affordable Care Act.
The Families USA report says 15.2 million Americans, 5.7% of the non-elderly population, have health insurance in the private marketplace rather than through employer-based group plans. Pollack says these are often Swiss cheese policies with big holes in coverage. The report found that 10.8 million of these people are income eligible for Affordable Care Act policies. Pollack says that means they will get more affordable, better insurance under the Affordable Care Act even if their current individual market policies are canceled. Put in perspective and in context, Obamacare benefits at least 90 million people, while just 0.6% of non-elderly Americans are at risk of losing unsubsidized coverage.
That number is a tiny fraction of the 65 million non-elderly people with pre-existing health conditions who will gain new protections through the Affordable Care Act. It is also a small fraction of the tens of millions of uninsured Americans who can also get help through new health coverage.
Registered nurses at Lawrence and Memorial Hospital in New London, Connecticut, say they won't be bullied by management threats to lock them out. The union nurses, represented by American Federation of Teachers Local 5049, say the lockout threat is just more of the same scare tactics from the corporation that runs the hospital. The 540 RNs and 250 LPNs want a new fair contract, including protections for patients and their families, as the corporation shifts services and caregiver jobs away from the hospital. The LPNs are members of AFT Local 5051. Both union locals have authorized strike action if necessary. The nurses say they hope to reach a mutual agreement, though, at the bargaining table without a strike. The nurses have filed unfair labor practice charges and have warned the hospital that a four-day work stoppage could begin as soon as Wednesday. As holiday gifts giving kicks into gear, don't forget Workers Independent News. Listener support helps sustain this newscast. Donate now at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Organizing America, 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
I tip my hat to the new Constitution. Take a bow for the new revolution. Sun and green of the change.
Hopefully we won't get fooled again. And I look at this governor who the more jobs governor. I love that. I love that frame. A guy who 49th in the country, they're saying, 49th in job creation, the more jobs governor. Yeah, I guess it's accurate. More than Wyoming, yes. Not much better than that. And I look at this claim that 200,000 jobs have been created by this governor in the drilling industry. And I loved the graphic that came along with one of the most recent articles that I read. It was the Pennsylvania Marcellus Shale related data, industry's data, put out by the Pennsylvania Quarterly Census of Employment and Wages, pointed out in 2009, there were 190,461 jobs in the drilling and ancillary industries category of the drillers. In 2009, first quarter, that's well before Governor Corbett took office. In the first quarter of 2013, just up to 203,000. You know, the 200,000 number he's throwing out there. So just in that 4 year span, you're talking about only 13,000 jobs created. And I would argue probably most of those were created before the governor said I do. Anyway, here to help us work through the $200,000 job nonsense is our good friend Dr. Steven Herzenberg from the Keystone Research Center. Steve, thanks for taking time for us.
Happy to do it, Rick.
So I understand there's a new study out from this multi-state shale research collaborative that's taking a look at this.
Absolutely. That's us. That is the Keystone Research Center and Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center working together with think tanks in West Virginia, Ohio, New York, and Virginia, and taking a look at what the jobs impact has and hasn't been of shale drilling, you know, in the footprint of the Marcellus and Utica shale play. Those two sources of gas are basically underneath the five states I just mentioned, plus Maryland. So, yeah, so there's been a lot of hype.
Yeah,
exactly
millions of jobs. It was going to be hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, the goose that laid the golden egg. So, so what we did is take a hard look at it. And, you know, there's some jobs, but there's more hype than there are jobs.
So how many? I mean, are we looking at, you know, I look at this, and like I pointed out, Before the governor took office, his numbers are saying there are 190,000 jobs to the drilling industry, 203,000 as of the first quarter of this year. That's not robust growth, in my view.
Well, it isn't. Now it turns out that those particular jobs are 97%, 98% nothing to do with drilling. Both the 200,000 he started with, now the 12,000 increase, you know, maybe that's partly to do with drilling.
So the long-distance truck driver jobs that had gone up, that has nothing to do with it? The long-distance freight jobs, that had nothing to do with it? The local freight jobs had nothing to do with it?
Well,
of course it did.
Well, exactly. I mean, that is, you work in the trucking industry. So you, again, part of these folks want a big number, right? They want a big number associated with drilling. And, in fact, again, our report begins with a little story with a reference to a Harrisburg Patriot News press story of about, you know, of some months back, where the U.S. and Pennsylvania Chamber of Commerce had a press conference to announce a whole new wave of communications on what a job boon the shale industry was. And, you know, and in their press conference, they were claiming, you know, 100,000 jobs, you know, within a matter of a few days, partly because even the Patriot News said your numbers are ridiculous. They backed off to only 180,000. But the best thing they did in this press conference is they were pretty open about why they were doing this, which is they were saying we're going to do this communication campaign around how many jobs there are, so that we don't have any, you know, premature regulation and taxation. So it's. They want people to think they're the goose that laid the golden egg. They want policymakers and the public to be afraid of saying boo to the drilling industry so that they can have their way when it comes to policy. And so, again, our goal here was basically to provide the facts. And the real number in terms of, is not hundreds of thousands, it's tens of thousands.
Right.
You're talking about across these six states, sort of 33,000 shale-related jobs since 2005. Now, you know, two-thirds of those are in Pennsylvania, but that's 22,000, not 200,000. And now, again, there are some multiplier effects. Those are some supply chain jobs, some consumer jobs that aren't in that 22,000 for Pennsylvania.
Some cleanup jobs.
Again,
some cleanup jobs, I'm sure.
Yeah. So,
you know, the water company that supplied water to the bottled water to the people in Dimmock who don't have water to drink anymore. Yeah, I'm sure.
But the answer
jobs.
Is what you know. You're talking tens of thousands of jobs, not hundreds of thousands of jobs. But when you look at that on the scale of the Pennsylvania economy or the economy of these six states, you know, it's not much. I mean, even in Pennsylvania, which West Virginia has the most drilling. Even in West Virginia, the shale-related jobs, when you count them right, are less than 1% of total jobs. In Pennsylvania, the shale-related jobs, when you count them right, are less than 0.5% of total jobs.
Explain to me what right is then, because you know, we keep hearing these big numbers, and as I understood it, and this just kind of blew my mind, that they come up with a number of how many people they've employed. So let's say, you know, someone took your job 10 different times. Hey, we created 10 jobs, even though it was still that one job that 10 people recycled through.
Well, that's right. That was what they did 2 years ago. What you just described, just for your listeners, is there was a whole lot of press a couple of years ago, about 48,000 jobs in the last couple of years, 72,000 jobs in the last couple of years, and that's because they discovered this number called new hires. And again, they looked at a list of shale-related industries, and they got a big number, and they sort of they went to town with this big number, and they didn't stop to think, well, does this number mean anything? And so, again, the number they went with, new hires, is not the same as new jobs, because 29 out of 30 new hires, think of McDonald's,
right,
is replacing somebody who just quit. New hires tells you exactly nothing about how many new jobs there are. You know, we have data on how many jobs there are in different industries. So you might want to use those to figure out.
Here again, that's someone like you who thinks about facts.
You know, well,
come on.
Yeah. So the most recent thing, there's been a whole spate of stories in the last month. Some of it associated with the kind of kickoff of the governor's gubernatorial campaign, and where again the number has been kicking around has been more than 200,000 jobs supported by shale, and they use this term ancillary jobs.
Right.
And again, I don't know how to explain this to your audience without going into the weeds to some extent, but it's ludicrous. I mean, what they do, this is what they did, is they had an internal discussion at the Pennsylvania Department of Labor and Industry, and they said, what are some industries where there are a bunch of jobs that support the drilling industry? And so trucking was one of the examples. You know, trucking is absolutely an industry where there are some jobs supporting drillers, like there are people driving water trucks to drill pads, right?
Or water and sewer.
So another example is water and sewer. So again, there are water issues in general around drilling. And so the water industry, you know, there are some jobs from water systems that are actually providing water directly to drillers. So are there some jobs in water and sewer infrastructure that support the drilling industry? Yes, there are.
So when a sinkhole happens here in Harrisburg, help me with this then.
Yeah.
So when we have one of our 42 sinkholes in the last year, and you've got people in there doing infrastructural improvements on our water and sewer lines because they've crumbled and the ground has crushed them into the ground. Are they counting that as a shale job?
You are exactly right. So that UPS driver, the whole trucking industry, basically, they've got like local freight. They've got, that's probably not UPS, they've got people delivering to, in the wholesale industry, delivering to Walmart, in Lancaster, which is, 100 miles or more from the nearest shale well. They're counting all of these jobs in this list of 30 industries where there are some jobs supporting drilling, but 90 out of 100, or in many cases, 99 out of 100 of the jobs are nothing to do with drilling.
Yeah. Well, it's the political messaging that they want. Hey, we've created jobs, which is why we haven't taxed them, and why you, the taxpayers, are picking up the tab for it.
It's a political message, but this is ridiculous stuff. And frankly, I mean, this is. At least at the federal level, the Bureau of Labor Statistics would never allow the kinds of numbers that have been abused to feed these distortions. So the idea that all these jobs that have nothing to do with drilling, to allow the impression to gather steam that they have to do with drilling, or the confusion between new hires and real jobs, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, if that stuff happened, at the U.S. Department of Labor would be out there saying loudly and clearly, you can't use these numbers this way. That's not what they mean.
Right.
So, there are some, there are some weak disclaimers. If you look at the stuff
it's the fine print of the fine print, though.
Yeah. But unfortunately, and again, it's not fair. I'm not being fair to the statistical folks, good folks that work in the Pennsylvania Department of Labor and Industry, because they don't really have the political independence
right. That
something like the Bureau of Labor Statistics has in Washington, D.C., and they don't have the stature, even though they do very important work. But it's appalling. I mean, these are just invented numbers, and hopefully we'll get enough of visibility on this report that people will realize that there's not a foundation for these claims. It doesn't mean there aren't any jobs.
But these aren't 200,000.
But it does mean, another thing it means is that this is not the answer. I mean, that from a policy point of view in Pennsylvania in particular, one of the problems has been that the drilling industry at times, the last couple of years, seems to have been the panacea. And if you've got an industry which has less than 0.5% of the jobs in the state, that you're treating nicely, but then you've got another industry like education and health combined. Instead of being one out of over 200 jobs, which is what the drilling jobs are, one out of more than 200 jobs. So education and healthcare are one out of every 6 jobs. But there we got policies that are leading to layoffs in schools, and we got another set of policies that are meaning we're not taking money from Washington that would create lots of jobs through Medicaid expansion, through providing people with health care who need it. Again, when you look at these jobs in context, and the shale industry in context, whether you're for fracking, responsible drilling, or you're against, you know, drilling because you're worried about the environmental impacts and the leakage of methane, whatever your position is, even if you're for it, it's a small part of an overall job strategy. And we've been treating it like a panacea.
Yeah, we've been bamboozled. And the thing that gets me is I'm not surprised with the misuse of the numbers. These are people who say we should be running our government like Enron anyway. So it doesn't surprise me when we have Arthur Anderson type accounting.
Right.
Which is how I view this. I see this is all that creative thing. You start off with what we want. We want big numbers. We want eye-popping numbers to say that we're creating jobs and it was worth all of the hundreds of millions of dollars that we've given away to this industry. It was worth it for our political gain. And then work your way back and make up the numbers as you go. So it's not surprising to me.
Fair enough. I guess, you know, I think we all project our own behavior to some extent on the rest of the world. And again, I do struggle with this stuff because my natural assumption is that when someone deals with data or gives you a quote fact, that it means something. And so I'm naive and probably easily misled, whereas you're probably
jaded.
You're probably jaded, but also in this case, you know, on target. I mean, they've got, you are exactly right, they've got a political agenda in terms of not wanting to be taxed, in terms of not wanting forceful regulation, in terms of, you know, wanting to be left alone by local officials and local communities. And, you know, if that means that they need to feed the myth of the mighty Marcellus with some suspect information, that's okay by them.
Yeah, I like that, the myth of the mighty Marcellus. That's good. Last line I've gone for you, because, you know, I looked at these numbers right when they came out, and you know, I was under the impression that the drilling industry was struggling because the price of natural gas is so low at this point. So the messaging to me is a bit off. We're creating all these jobs, but we're not drilling because the price is down. And it doesn't jive with me.
Well, I mean, you're exactly right in terms of in the last 12 months of data, the number of jobs, you know, in these states, you know, that are really related to the drilling industry has gone down. And, you know, some of it is the success of the amount of shale gas that has been drilled, and that's driven the price of natural gas down a lot, which has some benefit. But what it has meant is that it's not profitable. Or as profitable to drill, and so, you know, again, it, extractive industries, right? Oil, coal, lumber. I mean, there's a long history of boom and bust,
right,
in these kinds of industries, driven in part by price fluctuations. So, yeah, we do seem to be at the beginning of. Or partway into the beginning of what you might call a bustlet, and so whatever jobs you know were being created and whatever the growth was, it looks like for the next little while even that may level off.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing: I didn't want to pay for the boom, because I knew we were going to need the money for the bust. So that doesn't make me feel any better. But I'm glad to see someone was out there debunking this 200,000 job number myth that the more jobs governor, more than Wyoming, keeps spewing. And I appreciate the time and the work that you guys do over at the Keystone Research Center.
Thank you very much, Rick.
Thanks so much, Steve. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
As we approach our annual Feast of Thanksgiving, please join me in expressing our nation's deepest, heartfelt feelings for an extra special group of America's farmers. That raspberry goes out to the 50 billionaires who've been farming the U.S. Farm Subsidy Program for years, harvesting a cornucopia of taxpayer cash for themselves or their corporate empires. The diligent watchdogs of the Environmental Working Group match their own farm subsidy database with the Forbes 400 list of richest Americans to unmask these Gucci-wearing old McDonald's. E-I-E-I-O, what a ripoff! Among the richest of these faux farmers are three Walmart heirs whose personal wealth totals $100 billion. Then there's investment huckster Charles Schwab, sitting on a $5 billion wad of wealth, yet pumping $500,000 worth of rice subsidies into his California duck hunting resort. Also, corporate takeover artist Henry Kravis, who has amassed some $5 billion in wealth, took more than $1 million from us to subsidize safflower, sunflower, and other crops raised on two of his ranches. Especially jarring is the presence of such multi-billionaire right-wingers as oil and entertainment tycoon Philip Anschutz and nuclear waste mogul Harold Simmons. They've expressed disdain for government spending on poor people and other, quote, takers, yet they've gladly taken more than $500,000 each in farm payments. Actually, the working group's tally understates the total haul by these mega-rich tillers of our public treasury. Many also harvest crop insurance subsidies, but Congress has dutifully outlawed disclosure of these names to the public, even though it's our money they receive. This is Jim Hightower saying, in fact, these billionaires' most profitable ag products are the Congress creditors they keep in their corrals. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Gasoline, groceries, and our hate is. Everything's raisin, but the weight is.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. You know, I go back to this, and as Dr. Herzenberg pointed out, you know, any of these extraction industries, you're going to experience the booms and the busts. And what got me, and this is one of those things from the very beginning, when we were talking about, I don't even know if we were really talking about, when the governor and the Republicans were pushing this idea of not taxing the drillers. In fact, having a lesser extraction tax than states like Texas or West Virginia. Think about this. When you're leading the race to the bottom, when you're beating West Virginia to the bottom, there's kind of a problem there. But when they were pushing this through, the idea of no severance tax, no direct tax on this, I was saying, look, you know, this is what happens in these industries. You have booms, and a lot of investment comes flowing in, and in a hurry, you have a big buildup, and you know, a couple of people make a lot of money, and there are jobs that come along with it, and then all of a sudden, boom, It's done. And what's left behind? And I was saying from the beginning, what we do is we take the money that we're talking about giving them and keeping it and holding on to it. And saying we know at some point it's going to go pop. And that's when we use the money that we gave, would have given them to increase the boom to actually help solve the bust. Which, you know, in a rational, thoughtful society, don't you think that would be kind of the idea? You know, kind of a rainy day type, like, if we have to bring it home to kitchen table economics, the idea that, you know, you squirrel a couple of pennies away in the event that you lose a job or someone gets sick or whatever knows what. You know, when I first started working, an old timer took me aside and said, kid, make sure you got six months bills and living expenses squirreled away somewhere. Don't care where you put it in one of those banks, put it in a tin cup, do whatever, but squirrel away 6 months. At least. And I look at that in most frames. So I look at all of the money that we give in that industry through having the lowest impact fee, tax, whatever you want to call it, in the country on this drilling. And I said, you know, we should have had not the highest, but somewhere right there where everybody else is, and take that money, set it aside, because you know you're going to need cleanup, you know you're going to need to fix roads and bridges, you know you're going to have to come in and sweep up. You know you're going to have ghost towns to deal with, you know you're going to have the residual effects of all this. So why not pre-plan? Why not think about it as, you know, in the future, this is going to happen, I should probably start thinking about it. And then the political mind of mine pops in. Well, that doesn't make for good politics. That makes for good governance. That makes for smart vision into the future. But it doesn't really help the here or now. The here or now is, hey, we got this beautiful, we've got the golden egg. Let's squeeze that goose until it pops it all out. So we can have it all now. And the sad reality is that all now doesn't go to you and me and the working people of this Commonwealth. It goes to the handful. At the expense of our kids' education. At the expense of our infrastructure. And look, they just passed a $2 billion infrastructure transportation bill. It's going to be infrastructure. It's going to be public transit. And I say, well, yeah, that's a start, even though the governor's own report said you needed $3.5 billion. But it's a start. I mean, it's moving somewhere in the right direction. But at what cost to you and me? Here again, you're picking it up through higher fees, higher gas prices, and the drillers, well, they walked away. And I've talked to a number of people who have driving jobs with these drilling companies. They are destroying the roadways because they're in areas where the roadways and the infrastructure, it was never meant for industrial traffic. It was meant for hunters to go up and go up to the Rusty Gun cabin to spend a weekend drinking when their wives think they're hunting. It was meant as a getaway, as a way through. It was never meant for heavy industry, and they're tearing it to shreds. And who's going to have to fix it? You already know that, you and me. Anyway, let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Class majority. Rick Smith.
You're
listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
To hear Republicans and Fox News tell it, the Affordable Care Act is the coming of the apocalypse for untold millions of Americans with private market health insurance policies who are getting all those cancellation letters due to Obamacare. The truth, according to a careful new report from Families USA, is very different. Families USA's Ron Pollack.
The net result is that only a very tiny portion of the non-elderly population, less than 1%, by our calculation, 0.6%, are at risk of losing their current individual health insurance market plan due to the Affordable Care Act. The overwhelming majority of people with private individual health insurance today will soon be able to receive better coverage and pay lower premiums due to the Affordable Care Act.
The Families USA report says 15.2 million Americans, 5.7% of the non-elderly population, have health insurance in the private marketplace rather than through employer-based group plans. Pollack says these are often Swiss cheese policies with big holes in coverage. The report found that 10.8 million of these people are income eligible for Affordable Care Act policies. Pollack says that means they will get more affordable, better insurance under the Affordable Care Act even if their current individual market policies are canceled. Put in perspective and in context, Obamacare benefits at least 90 million people, while just 0.6% of non-elderly Americans are at risk of losing unsubsidized coverage.
That number is a tiny fraction of the 65 million non-elderly people with pre-existing health conditions who will gain new protections through the Affordable Care Act. It is also a small fraction of the tens of millions of uninsured Americans who can also get help through new health coverage.
Registered nurses at Lawrence and Memorial Hospital in New London, Connecticut, say they won't be bullied by management threats to lock them out. The union nurses, represented by American Federation of Teachers Local 5049, say the lockout threat is just more of the same scare tactics from the corporation that runs the hospital. The 540 RNs and 250 LPNs want a new fair contract, including protections for patients and their families, as the corporation shifts services and caregiver jobs away from the hospital. The LPNs are members of AFT Local 5051. Both union locals have authorized strike action if necessary. The nurses say they hope to reach a mutual agreement, though, at the bargaining table without a strike. The nurses have filed unfair labor practice charges and have warned the hospital that a four-day work stoppage could begin as soon as Wednesday. As holiday gifts giving kicks into gear, don't forget Workers Independent News. Listener support helps sustain this newscast. Donate now at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I got this press release that says there's a new coalition of Hunger Games fans, and I'm not sure if everyone has seen the movie. I haven't yet. My wife is you know, saying we got to go see this, and this is going to make me want to go out and see it now, because I'm not into that yet. She's a huge Harry Potter fan, huge sci-fi fan. So this kind of, when I saw this press release, kind of goes, you know, perfect opportunity to talk about it. The Harry Potter Alliance has announced this Odds in Our Favor campaign to mobilize fans of Harry Potter and also of Hunger Games to talk about income inequality and economic inequality here in the U.S. and around the world, which is why we've asked Andrew Slack. He is the Harry Potter Alliance's executive director, creator, and co-founder. To come talk about the Odds in Our Favor campaign. Andrew, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, Rick. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be talking on your show tonight. How are you?
I am fantastic. And I got to be honest with you, I haven't read the books. My wife and my kids have. In fact, this week they're doing the movie marathon of Harry Potter. So when I saw this, I'm like, this is somebody I got to talk to. just from that front, because, you know, I see the power of that story. I haven't read it, but it's so, it grabs my kids, and it's grabbed really an entire generation. And from my view, to use that to start talking about how we change the world in reality, to me is a fantastic idea and a step in the right direction.
Well, thank you, Rick. You know, I'm 34. I started reading Harry Potter when I was 23 at the urging of kids I was working with. I didn't want to read the books. When I read them, I fell in love with them, and I was just swept away. It really brought back a lot of feelings of being a kid. But as the books advance, they become more like literature and less like just children's literature, but literature for everyone. And it's very apparent that J.K. Rowling used to work at Amnesty International. Those parallels are clear in the books. And what I began to feel annoyed with as I fell in love with the books was that even though the online Harry Potter fan community was so huge and energetic and incredible, if Harry Potter were in our world, wouldn't he do more than simply celebrate being Harry Potter? Wouldn't he fight for justice in our world the way he fought for justice in his? In fact, in the books, he starts a student activist group called Dumbledore's Army, and the members of Dumbledore's Army advocate for equal rights to various different species in the books, werewolves and half-giants, and then humans such as muggleborns, et cetera. It all sounds pretty far out, but it's all about equal rights there. They also wake the world up to the fact that Voldemort is back, which the consolidated media and the government are denying is true. So we became a Dumbledore's Army for our world, and over the years, we've done everything involving service, like sending 5 cargo planes to Haiti, building libraries across the world, funding the protection of civilians in Darfur and Burma, to actually doing real advocacy on the Maryland Dream Act, on marriage equality, and a series of other different forms of advocacy on media reform, and always connecting it back to the text and the books. Since then, we've gotten close to 200 chapters. We have 6 full-time employees and 40 volunteer staff, and we've gotten the honor to be covered in almost every major publication with J.K. Rowling praising us in Time magazine. So what we're doing now is taking this methodology of the power of a popular story to make social justice popular and going beyond Hogwarts, going into others' popular stories such as The Hunger Games.
Yeah, and I look at the Hunger Games and you go, yeah, are we living in a much different world now? I mean, from what I've read about it, it puts me into this moment where we really have two societies, and you've got one that's fighting over just basic substance.
Yeah, it's kind of an unbelievable parallel. I mean, the economic inequality in The Hunger Games is just so unbelievable, except sadly it's so believable. Our main character, Katniss Everdeen, we start in the first book, and her father was forced to work as a coal miner because there were no other options. I mean, the sort of Walmartization of the world has stripped so many Americans of their options for work, at least 20 million, as imagine you know, can't find full-time jobs. So he's working in a coal mine. The capital in the Hunger Games consolidates all the wealth, and the people in the districts, such as Katniss and her family, they're stripped of their resources. So, yes, he's unearthing different resources in the mines, but those are being taken to the capital, and then they don't have safety regulations. There are no unions. Once again, we have that problem in the U.S. About 6% of Americans are protected in their jobs by unions. Their jobs could be a lot safer if they were protected by unions.
Yep.
In the meantime, Katniss's dad dies. Her mom falls into a deep depression because of death. She loses her job. There are no food stamps. There are no unemployment benefits. Welcome to the Tea Party's vision of liberty and freedom, apparently. And now Katniss and her family are starving to death and have no choice
but to fight to the death. And I go back and I think of some of the quotes I've read from Thomas Jefferson. And, one of them was about military. May nobody have to put their life on the line for a sixpence. And you look at some of this stuff and you go, right now we're living some of the greatest fears of our founders. And, I often wonder what they would think if they were here today to see what we've done. And what you pointed out with the Hunger Games, to me that sounds like conservative paradise. You're on your own. Hooray, good luck. You've got the freedom to, well, to die in the street.
Yeah, I mean, that's like, welcome to freedom. It certainly isn't consistent with the president that defeated fascism, FDR, and his concept of freedom from fear and freedom from want. I don't know if it's really the paradise that conservatives believe in, or so much as they're just so blinded and paralyzed by their own psychological fears regarding changes in society that they've gotten locked into this kind of belief system. And then you know, you add the glamour of the Capitol, this wish that maybe one day I'm in District 6, I'll end up in the Capitol, and it's just not going to happen. It's not going to happen because, as they say in the Hunger Games, may the odds be ever in your favor. Well, the odds are never in your favor. They're not in our favor, but they can be. We can change the odds. That is something that our founders built into the system, and that can be changed if we can really challenge the Capitol here. And I don't mean simply the U.S. Capitol. I mean the larger Capitol that owns our congresspeople, which is the bank system and the system that got us into this mess in 2008.
Yeah. So, you know, as I look at this, and I'm intrigued because, you know, the Harry Potter books have really grabbed my kids. And, you know, if this is the way to get them into activism as they grow older, I'm all in favor. And to be honest with you, I never read the books because they're like what, 700 pages long? And I just don't have that kind of time.
They're a long read, yeah.
But the message is, you know, as my kids are telling me about it and they're excited about it, and I think it's a step in the right direction. And it does, to me, show the power of story and the power of narrative. And this is where I think people like, you know, like me or like you who say that we should have equal rights for folks, and people, workers should have rights on the job, and we should have a social safety net so that no one dies in the streets or is put in a situation where, you know, you have to fight to the death to be able to feed your family. We don't have that narrative like the right wing has of the, you know, luck be on your side. You know, hey, you're going to hit the lottery, or you're going to be the next Bill Gates or the next widget inventor. We don't really have that narrative.
Yeah, and that's sad because I believe we once did have that narrative. I think that that during the 30s and the 40s and the 50s even, we had that narrative when labor was stronger. In the New Deal and the Great Society during the Civil Rights era, that narrative was very strong. And somehow, well, for very complicating reasons, I believe we lost control of that narrative, and we have to get it back. And the joy of getting it back is that it's the truth. It's not simply like hijacking a narrative. It's just simply exposing. It's combining the truth with a good story.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. But, you know, let me ask you this, Andrew, because, you know, I said after 2008 that maybe this was an opportunity for people who were struggling to then begin to organize and do what labor had done in the past and organizations had done in the past, because you had people who were truly suffering in the streets. There were long bread lines. This country was being ripped apart during the Great Depression because there were people starving in the streets. And is it that we aren't suffering enough that we're not seeing that kind of organizing? Has it not hit enough people to where we're saying enough is enough already? Or is it just we're not seeing it yet?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I mean, you know, I'm wondering what you think.
Well, my thought is simply that through our social safety net programs, because we had unemployment insurance, because we had food stamps, that it didn't hit us as hard as it did during the Depression. And my grandparents' generation, I had a great opportunity to talk to people who their working lives were during the Depression. And they told stories of this country in turmoil, people in the streets, you know, who couldn't feed their families, men who would bring bread home after standing in line all day in the bread line, leaving it on the table and leaving in the house so they wouldn't eat anything. That's what that generation saw. So they were more apt to come together and say, you know what, we need to be fighting for better for all of us. Instead of being able to be divided and split against one another because, well, it's those people who are pulling us down or those people or this or that, without really looking at the true cause, which Wall Street and the capital people who run this country, that to me is where the problem is.
Well, and we're in total agreement here. I think I think the problem is that, first of all, I hope it doesn't get to that point. And we can't risk, there's a lot of risk if we ever got to be that off again. And the casualty is just too high. So right. I think ultimately, you know, one of the gifts that I've been given in my career is I get to witness real communities being created online. And, you know, a lot of people are naysayers about how, like, you know, the virtual world is not real. I have seen true friendships with kids who are dying, by the way, who are terminally ill, forming real friendships that are part of authentic communities. Harry Potter, at the end of the day, is all about love. Hunger Games, Saving Grace, is all about the tenderness between human beings within that fight for justice. We're seeing that over the Internet. We're also seeing desensitization, of course. We're seeing the NSA spying. We're seeing Time Warner trying to control everything. But we're also seeing something we've never seen before. So I think it's important that we who are progressives need to stand on our – need to play good defense, and we are losing on defense right now, meaning to protect the FDR safeguards of food stamps and New Deal and Great Society benefits. That's our defense.
Social Security, all
but our offense, though, hasn't been created yet. We need to go beyond the 1930 solution. We can't just be sticking a 1930s peg in a 2013 hole. So yes, we definitely need the social safety nets that we already have, and we need to go beyond that. And I don't know what that necessarily looks like. But I do know what it doesn't look like. And what it doesn't look like is cutting the things from the 1930s. We need to build on those things and build schools and build educational systems where our young people who they're not our future, they're our present. And they can create more messaging than you or I, a video of a child biting his brother's finger has 500 million views on YouTube. If we can do that and get that viral on YouTube, we can make social justice viral on YouTube. And it's really 16 and 17-year-olds that can do that, that are equipped to do that. So they're being raised on books like Harry Potter. They're being raised on books like The Hunger Games. And The Hunger Games is this incredible opportunity to really discuss economic inequality and hopefully to unite and connect with those who are fighting for it. We were greatly honored that the president of the AFL-CIO, President Trumka, joined us. The symbol of economic solidarity in The Hunger Games is the three-finger salute. Just take your – it's almost like a Boy Scout, so it's a little different. Just the your middle three fingers, and you bring them up, and you hold them high. And Trumka did it, and somewhere between 9 and 12 union presidents did it, and they made a map of Panem, which is the country, the future U.S., in The Hunger Games. And they put them all over the U.S., the AFL-CIO, and they're seeing that this is an effective way to communicate. So they're picking up on our methodology, and we're really excited that they're doing that. Sadly, Lionsgate, the movie studio behind the Hunger Games, has taken one of the most anti-classist blockbusters we've ever seen and turned it into one of the most class-based, conspicuous consumerism marketing that we've ever seen. I mean, they're using it to push CoverGirl fashion line. Jennifer Lawrence, her character is forced to wear makeup in the movies before she fights to the death, and she's forced to do this, and the makeup is served as a distraction. And CoverGirl is the company that they use the makeup for. They're marketing that makeup as the Capital Collection. It's very sick. So I had an LA Times article today out sort of just exposing, and many other people have done this too, just how transparently gross Lionsgate has been about this. But ultimately, it comes down to this. The first rule about classism in America is don't talk about classism. The second rule about classism in America is don't talk about classism. And the third rule about classism in America is if you have to talk about classism, blame the poor for their poverty. Blame the people in the districts. Don't blame the Capitol. Don't blame Wall Street. But we're doing that as fans. We're picking up where Lionsgate failed. We are picking up and we're honoring Suzanne Collins' message and the message of all great civil rights leaders and working for economic equality with the AFL-CIO, with other progressive organizations. And we're really raising consciousness here to then build a much larger movement that's going to continue through these final films. There will be two more final films. And hopefully get those food stamps back and create new programs, ones that we haven't even dreamed of yet. And I think there's a real chance here to take the power of the story to better and improve upon the story of America at this critical time in the American narrative.
So the website, hpalliance.org, the Harry Potter Alliance, hpalliance.org.
It's actually thehpalliance.org, but if anyone's interested in this campaign, it's oddsinourfavor.org.
And that's what I was going to ask you about. Explain, how can we be involved? What can I do to help? How can I get my kids involved? What do we do?
Okay, so oddsinourfavor.org, you go to it, you'll see people giving three-finger salutes. Take a selfie, a picture of yourself doing a three-finger salute, and upload it on our website. Immediately then you get put in our action network, and we're going to send you messages on things to do as time goes on that are connected to the films but also connected to real life. Whether it's a Walmart protest, whether it's something to do with media reform, any of those things, you're going to be in our network. But beyond that, we have a Tumblr called wearethedistricts.tumblr.com. You can go to that as well, wearethedistricts.tumblr.com, and that's a lot of real-life stories of people. We want people submitting stories of their communities, of either economic injustice happening or of the good work that's being done in their communities by fantastic people and fantastic organizations. But beyond that, every time Lionsgate posts anything promoting the Capitol, we're getting people who have posted their three-finger salutes to saturate any social media comment that Lionsgate posts promoting the CoverGirl baloney and all that stuff with pictures of their three-finger salute and articles pointing to economic equality issues and all of that. But this is really just the beginning. This is not this is just about catching fire in essence, which is the name of the movie. It's about really bringing this to light and creating a pop culture movement about economic equality. I want to see Senator Elizabeth Warren hopefully doing a three-finger salute. I want to see us incorporating the three-finger salute into rallies across the country when we work for economic equality. But as far as what you can do right now, the very simple thing is going to oddsinourfavor.org, posting a selfie, putting it there, make it your Facebook post, tell people why. It's essentially admitting that we have a problem as a country. That's the first step towards recovery, is admitting we have a problem, and we do. When it comes to economic equality, we have a problem, and that's the first step towards our real recovery, not simply the jobless recovery we've had since 2008.
Well, I'm thrilled to hear that you're doing this. I would love to have you back on the program often as this goes down the road, as you expand this and we get more people involved.
Well, thank you so much. It's an honor to be on, and thank you to all your listeners and for caring about this critical issue. I love the state of Pennsylvania. It's where I'm from. So thank you, and please keep carrying on.
I will, absolutely. Andrew Slack, thanks so much. Executive Director, Creator, Co-Founder of the Harry Potter Alliance, oddsinourfavor.org of the campaign that they want you to get involved in. We've got links at therickssmithshow.com. Quick break, right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
This is why we fight, why we
for the rest of us. Rick Smith.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
Somehow I had a memory of learning in school that our Thanksgiving holiday was established by the pilgrims that came over on the Mayflower. But I discovered that President George Washington issued the first Thanksgiving proclamation on November 26, 1789. And thus began the long and winding path to whether and when America would celebrate the holiday. It would not be until the year 1956 that a final unified Thanksgiving Day would be established. The early presidents after George Washington were not particularly keen on declaring Thanksgivings, mostly because it was perceived as a New England or Yankee tradition, and many of the early presidents were from Virginia. So it became somewhat of a regional celebration. And then came along New England novelist Sarah Hale. If there is a mother of Thanksgiving, it would be Ms. Hale. Join me next time to find out the results of Ms. Hale's efforts to establish a Thanksgiving holiday. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
For many, the 8-hour day is the standard, but it wasn't always this way. The original American workday was from sunup to sundown, following the demands of an agricultural workday. Over time, the nation became more industrialized and workers moved from individually owned, self-sufficient farms to factories, taking workers from their homes and families. Factory owners demanded the agricultural sunup to sundown workday, forcing workers to toil long hours in grueling conditions. Workers began to collectively organize in pursuit of more time for family, education, and recreation. The cry of 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will grew louder. For a century, the 8-hour day was viewed as the holy grail of the labor movement, and for this hallowed vision, workers sacrificed, often with their blood and their lives. The first strike for shorter hours occurred in May of 1791 in the city of Philadelphia, where carpenters protested a day's wages, paying the same in January as was paid for a longer day in July. Chicago in 1886 was home to one of the largest showings of solidarity. Some 80,000 workers turned out to support the 8-hour cause. It was in Chicago's Haymarket Square that a terrorist bomb and the blazing guns of company-paid police cost policemen and numerous workers their lives and their blood. As a result of the Haymarket tragedy, 8 innocent men were tried and convicted for a crime they did not commit. 4 of the men were hung. The Haymarket Square tragedy was but one of many battles in which working men, women, and children shed blood, tears, and flesh in the pursuit of 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness.
I gotta tell you, I'm... You know, the kids and my wife are just fixated on this Harry Potter stuff. And, you know, this has given me really a whole new look on it. You know, I look at 700-800 page books and I go, oh, really? No. But, you know, maybe, you know, who knows? Maybe I will actually sit down and read one of them at this point. And look, I've encouraged him reading the books because I think kids need to read them. But now that he's given me this, the message, I kind of like it. Maybe we'll see. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher on your smartphone. You can get the program on the go. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Any thoughts, any comments, especially on this, I'm going to follow up with this. I think this is an excellent idea of getting people involved and engaging folks around. Because I was just having this conversation over the weekend with a friend about, you know, where's the protest music? Where's the Johnny Paycheck, take this job and shove it? Where's the message of conditions that are going on and the inequality and the music and stuff? And, you know, I hadn't really thought of this. So this kind of opens up a thought for me. Anyway, I'm going to take a quick break. Right back with Hour 3. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
90% of the world. 10% of the people. Oh, 90% of the world. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people. Oh, 90% of the world.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
To hear Republicans and Fox News tell it, the Affordable Care Act is the coming of the apocalypse for untold millions of Americans with private market health insurance policies who are getting all those cancellation letters due to Obamacare. The truth, according to a careful new report from Families USA, is very different. Families USA's Ron Pollack.
The net result is that only a very tiny portion of the non-elderly population, less than 1%, by our calculation, 0.6%, are at risk of losing their current individual health insurance market plan due to the Affordable Care Act. The overwhelming majority of people with private individual health insurance today will soon be able to receive better coverage and pay lower premiums due to the Affordable Care Act.
The Families USA report says 15.2 million Americans, 5.7% of the non-elderly population, have health insurance in the private marketplace rather than through employer-based group plans. Pollack says these are often Swiss cheese policies with big holes in coverage. The report found that 10.8 million of these people are income eligible for Affordable Care Act policies. Pollack says that means they will get more affordable, better insurance under the Affordable Care Act even if their current individual market policies are canceled. Put in perspective and in context, Obamacare benefits at least 90 million people, while just 0.6% of non-elderly Americans are at risk of losing unsubsidized coverage.
That number is a tiny fraction of the 65 million non-elderly people with pre-existing health conditions who will gain new protections through the Affordable Care Act. It is also a small fraction of the tens of millions of uninsured Americans who can also get help through new health coverage.
Registered nurses at Lawrence and Memorial Hospital in New London, Connecticut, say they won't be bullied by management threats to lock them out. The union nurses, represented by American Federation of Teachers Local 5049, say the lockout threat is just more of the same scare tactics from the corporation that runs the hospital. The 540 RNs and 250 LPNs want a new fair contract, including protections for patients and their families, as the corporation shifts services and caregiver jobs away from the hospital. The LPNs are members of AFT Local 5051. Both union locals have authorized strike action if necessary. The nurses say they hope to reach a mutual agreement, though, at the bargaining table without a strike. The nurses have filed unfair labor practice charges and have warned the hospital that a four-day work stoppage could begin as soon as Wednesday. As holiday gifts giving kicks into gear, don't forget Workers Independent News. Listener support helps sustain this newscast. Donate now at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show. What they do.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Got an email during the break, and you can email me too, Rick at therickssmithshow.com. John sent the email asking, whatever happened to Timmy Geithner? He asks, you know, you talk about income inequality, Mr. Income Inequality himself, former head of the New York Federal Reserve, who John blames a good portion on Timothy Geithner on the collapse of 2008. Evidently, as I looked it up, Timmy, who claimed he was not going to go work on Wall Street, he said, you know, I guess he had done an interview right before he left, said he was not going to take a job on Wall Street. And then he said, well, it'd be extremely unlikely that he would take a job on Wall Street. Well, he did. he's now the president of the private equity firm Warburg Pincus LLC. So there you go. Said they weren't going to do it, but hey, you know, the money. It's the money. And I guess once you get to that point, you know, it really just is all about the money, isn't it? And you know, in thinking about the interview there with Andrew Slacker, which I got to have back because you know this is one of those tough interview moments because I didn't read any of the books. And I'll be quite candid about it. They just didn't see. To me, they seemed like they were kids' books, they were fantasy books, and that's just not my world. I'm more of an academic fact type book. I don't do much pleasure reading, and for me, that would fall into that. I just don't have the luxury of that time. And you know, when you're 12, 13, like my daughter, 11, has read all of them, and they're like 700 pages a piece, and I think there's like 7, 8 of them. I don't know. There's a whole bunch of them. And over the summer, she read all of them. I'm going, wow. By the time I was 11, I don't think I read 700 pages, let alone 700 pages in a multiple format. But, you know, she's just enthralled by them. And, look, you know, when you're that age, that's when my thought was, that's when you have the time and the luxury to do that kind of pleasure reading. Unfortunately, I don't. But it's kind of made me want to go back and maybe revisit, if I can find the time, of at least, you know, doing like Rodney Dangerfield in Back to School said. You know, you go and you see the movie. You're in and out 2 hours. You got the gist of it. Because I did know, and as my producer pointed out during the break, you do know that they're different authors. And I did. I did know that The Hunger Games was written by Susan Collins and the J.K. Rowling woman wrote the Harry Potter series. I knew that. And that's why I don't like getting into interviews where I haven't done that homework. But to be honest, I didn't have time to read a couple 700-page books and the other one before the interview. So I think he knew that, and he was very gracious about it. But, you know, for me, it's what I find exciting about what Andrew Slack is doing is engaging and activating people who might not otherwise have a reason to be engaged and activated. And then as I was, you know, I was thinking about it, I was going, you know, maybe this is why they're going to start banning those books. Because we don't want to put that kind of thought into people's heads. So, you know, and going through this, and I'm going to spend a little time thinking about it over the next couple of days, because I may actually go see The Hunger Games. I don't know. Maybe I'll see the movie. There's part of me says maybe I shouldn't, because, like he points out, you know, they're glamorizing it. So I'm kind of torn. Just kind of torn on this. But I just, you know, I'm excited to see that there might be some kind of narrative. There might be some kind of thought that goes into organizing. You know, like I said in the last hour, you know, I went up to the Penn State game, so I had a good hour and a half in the car with a friend of mine who's a bit older than I am, and we were talking about, you know, the music of the past, where, you know, it was talking about, you know, the frames that were important to a generation, and I was, you know, I was, you know, kind of just musing about, you know, why don't we hear the younger generation who is heavily saddled with debt, who is in a juncture where, you know what, there's virtually no opportunity. The unemployment rate for someone under 25 is through the roof. All of these things that you would think would come out in music or art or any of these things. And you know, I wonder, you know, is it out there? Is it that I'm not seeing it? But, you know, you go back and you think about Ohio, you know, about the Kent State situation. You think about the, you know, Johnny Paycheck with the take this job and shove it and the crummy working conditions. And you could go back and there are a bunch of songs and a bunch of things that at the time, that's what was going on. And I'm not seeing it. And maybe it hits on a theme, as he pointed out in the interview, that you've got this kind of control, this kind of command, and this kind of control that says, you know, we're not gonna let you see that, and we're gonna glamorize the bad things you do see. That's what's I guess that's what's frustrating. And as he kind of turned it around on me, well, what do you think of why we haven't suffered enough. You know, even the people who have suffered, you know, we've blamed them first, but then we kind of make them out to be heroes when they finally get a job. See, they pulled themselves up by the bootstraps. It's just, you know, it grabs me, and it's something I'm going to spend a considerable time over the next several weeks, probably racking my brains about. Anyway, our quote of the day comes from Ricardo Fuentes. He was quoted in the article, "Widening Inequality Shatters Mirage of Social Mobility." He says, "We know from history that having a more equal society is not a utopian objective." And, you know, I look at this, and it's not a utopian objective. It's a possible, it's very real and very possible. Because we have had, at other points in our history, a more equal society. back when you had workers who had some measure of economic power. And I don't think you can have social equality without economic equality. I don't think it's possible. And I point to our stat of the day from Demos, a study put out by Demos, which I generally don't like to quote them because they're like the middle of the road folks. But they point out something very interesting, that had Walmart applied the $7.6 billion it spent buying back shares last year, had they given that to the workers instead of buying back their shares, $7.6 billion, and, you know, the same thing they had done when they gave $2.6 billion in dividends last year to their billionaire heirs, you know, the sperm lottery winners of the Walton family. Had they taken that more than $10.2 billion and divvied it up between all of their full-time workers, they could have had all of their workers making at least $25,000 instead of less than half. Which they were very proud of. Got to give them credit. They were very proud of that. That less than half of their workers make $25,000 a year. Now, this is a company that had $10.2 billion in extra money that they could pay out in dividends to the sperm lottery winners and buy back shares of their company with. So you think about it, because I'm struggling to see the decision they made as the right one for society. Now, for the sperm lottery winners, obviously, good for them. Good news today at the Bentonville headquarters. Walmart's had replaced their CEO and president, Mike Duke. They have named the 47-year-old Doug McMillan as his successor. Evidently, McMillan comes from their international division. He ran Walmart International. Now, the way it's kind of laid out, the way that, you know, this whole thing is kind of gone, they're saying that, you know, Duke is leaving because of the scandal that broke in Mexico. Evidently, the Department of Justice, the Securities Exchange Commission, both of them are investigating the possibilities of bribery and the potential evidence of bribery there in Mexico, and they're also looking at possibly Brazil, China, and India as well. They say that they may have violated the U.S. Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which is a no-no, and I go, well, what if he does? What if he did? What if they find that they did this and there's overwhelming evidence? Does anybody go to jail? And the answer is, well, no. No, they'll pay a fine. But Mr. Duke is leaving. He's been replaced. He will stay on for a year, though. The reports didn't talk about what the conditions of the year will be, what kind of money that they're going to put into his pocket, what kind of golden parachute he's going to have when he completes his year, how much pension, how much health care, how much of these special perks and privileges that our CEO class get. I'm sure it won't be in the Jack Welch range, but I'm sure not going to be in there's the door. Don't let it hit you where the good Lord splits your range either. I'm sure he will do very fine. Thank you very much. Probably not going to get flowers in every one of his 16 homes every day, but I'm sure he will not want, which is just absolutely amazing. And I want to finish up with Stephen Greenhouse over the New York Times had an interesting article the other day. Remember, we had talked extensively about the factory collapse in Bangladesh where 1,127 workers were killed. We also talked about the fires that went on, the Tazreen factory fire, if I remember right, and of course the Rana Plaza building that collapsed. You're talking 1,300 people killed, hundreds if not thousands more injured. According to Greenhouse, he points out that the International Labor Organization, the ILO, is working with Bangladeshi officials, labor groups, and several retailers to create this compensation fund so that the families of the dead can survive. There are 1,800 workers in this that are, I guess, some of them still hospitalized. Turns out Walmart, Sears, Children's Place, a number of these other places that have sold goods created by these factories, they are refusing to contribute to this fund. And it's getting the ire of some of the international community, and there are some that are contributing. And look, you know, for me, this is another one of those moments where the country, and us as well as a country, should say, you know what, we're not going to allow that kind of stuff to happen. We're not going to allow those conditions to exist, and you still to bring those products into this country. To me, it seems rational that you have a baseline safety net for all workers. I mean, if we can't pull up working conditions around the world, what's going to happen to ours? I think quite simply, we know they're going to fall. Simple, simple, simple logic. I'm going to take a quick break right back. Stick around. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
As we approach our annual feast of Thanksgiving, please join me in expressing our nation's deepest, heartfelt feelings for an extra special group of America's farmers. That raspberry goes out to the 50 billionaires who've been farming the U.S. Farm Subsidy Program for years, harvesting a cornucopia of taxpayer cash for themselves or their corporate empires. The diligent watchdogs of the Environmental Working Group match their own farm subsidy database with the Forbes 400 list of richest Americans to unmask these Gucci-wearing old McDonald's. E-I-E-I-O, what a ripoff! Among the richest of these faux farmers are three Walmart heirs whose personal wealth totals $100 billion. Then there's investment huckster Charles Schwab, sitting on a $5 billion wad of wealth, yet pumping $500,000 worth of rice subsidies into his California duck hunting resort. Also, corporate takeover artist Henry Kravis, who has amassed some $5 billion in wealth, took more than $1 million from us to subsidize safflower, sunflower, and other crops raised on two of his ranches. Especially jarring is the presence of such multi-billionaire right-wingers as oil and entertainment tycoon Philip Anschutz and nuclear waste mogul Harold Simmons. They've expressed disdain for government spending on poor people and other, quote, takers, yet they've gladly taken more than $500,000 each in farm payments. Actually, the working group's tally understates the total haul by these mega-rich tillers of our public treasury. Many also harvest crop insurance subsidies, but Congress has dutifully outlawed disclosure of these names to the public, even though it's our money they receive. This is Jim Hightower saying, in fact, these billionaires' most profitable ag products are the Congress critters they keep in their corrals.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So I found out something interesting today. Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican minority leader in the Senate, he is saying, running around saying that he He has worked his entire career for pay equality and pay equity. Worked his entire career. Now, this is a guy who twice voted against the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. Twice voted against it. Twice voted against the Paycheck Fairness Act. But where he's saying, you know, hey, I'm in favor of it, this whole, and I even hate to say that it has anything to do with flexibility. This pushing of the Republican view of job creating and the Republican view of helping families, which is this flexibility act or whatever the heck they call it, which would say, okay, you know, we're going to, as an employer, say, well, you know what, I don't have any work for you this week. You know, I'll work you 80 hours next week and I'll pay you straight time. But they're saying, well, you would have the choice. You would have the flexibility of taking comp time instead of, you know, working overtime when you needed it. Yet the language that they've put forth has none of the A, volunteer, or B, your choice in it, which we all know. Once you put this into place, you have just destroyed overtime in the country. But I find it interesting that McConnell is out there saying that he's the champion. And look, you know, I've been seeing a lot of conversation around raising the minimum wage. I've been seeing a lot of messaging. The Democrats are, you know, putting out all of their spin wheels going, yeah, let's raise the minimum wage. Yeah. Obama said he's behind raising it to $10 an hour. We've seen a lot of this talk. And why is that? Is it because, well, they finally got around to it? Is it because they finally, oh, yeah, hey, this wouldn't be a bad idea? Or is it because you've got thousands of people in the streets? Is it because you're seeing people taking to the curb? You know, and I've been saying this for the longest time. The only time things get changed is when you and me and the rest of, when the rabble gets worked up, when the unwashed masses get worked up and get into the streets and start going, you know what? You're not getting your cheeseburger. You know what? You're not getting until we get something. Because you're seeing all these fast food forward campaigns. You're seeing all these fast food workers saying, you know what? We want $15 an hour. You're seeing these retail workers saying, you know what? We want a decent living. And now with all of this pressure and all this messaging, now the Democrats are, oh, okay, you know, we better do something. And I look at Mr. I've always worked my entire career for pay equity, who has been one of the guys who, well, not such a good voting record on it. And a guy who has worked to block the Employee Free Choice Act, and a guy who, you know, everything that I would deem as a step forward for working people, he's been in the way of. So I find it interesting that now, when he's in a tough campaign, oh, you know what? I'm Mr. Fighter for the middle class. It's just amazing to me. And I saw this news report, and I can't remember where it was. We were it was on Saturday where we had the radio on. I was driving, like I said, the state college that watched the Penn State game, and in a hurry, because, and much to the chagrin of my friend who has season tickets, my daughter's basketball game happened to be at 1:30 on on Saturday. The Penn State game was at 3:30. We finished up the game at, and this is moving, so I hope there are no state police listening. We finished up the game at 2:30. I got to the car by 2:40. We were in State College by 5 to 4. So we were exceeding by just a little bit. But we made it there in time. But while I'm in the car, you know, I heard this news report come on, and it was like almost like this sense of amazement that, you know, retail workers at certain places were on call. And I know there have been other news reports done. I know the Workers Independent News has done it, but it was on like the mainstream, like kind of like a mainstream station saying, can you believe that there are people who are on call? And I go, yeah, I've been screaming about that for years. And I was explaining it to a friend who was doing some work for us, saying, you know, because he had never heard of anybody being on call. I said, well, you know, this is how it works. the employer says, I might need you tomorrow. I don't know when, and I don't know if. So tomorrow you're going to have to sit by your phone. And you're going to have to wait. And maybe I call, maybe I don't. And maybe I use you, maybe I don't. And you don't get paid. And, oh, by the way, you can't go work somewhere else. This is what's permeated. I mean, really permeated the retail industry and the fast food industry. A lot of these low wage jobs, this is what they've done. Because here at the base of it, they've got desperate folks, people who desperately need a job. And these employers understand that. They understand desperation. So, well, why not use it to their advantage, right? So as we're talking about this, I explained, you know, I remember back when I started, you know, working, you know, in the freight industry, we had the trucking industry was notorious for having these two-hour work calls. And maybe it got called, maybe it didn't. And this was before cell phones, so you were literally tethered to the house. And you had 2 hours to get there or you got fired eventually. And, you know, I was against it then. It was a bad idea then, and it's still a bad idea. And it's a much worse idea when you're talking about a job where you're making minimum wage. So I just I find it interesting that I think a lot of it has to do with we don't really know what it's like. We don't know what others are going through. And I think it's because, you know, look, I'm as proud as anybody, and I'm as private as anybody. But I think when you're being abused, I think when you're in a bad situation, you gotta speak out and say something, right? I mean, just a thought. Anyway, good news today. The year was 2002. George W. Bush signed the Department of Homeland Security into law and named our former governor, Tom Ridge, as the first secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. Is that a good thing? Is it a bad thing? I was never a Homeland Security fan. I know it was a Joe Lieberman thought. I was never a big Joe Lieberman fan. But today, back in 2002, 11 short years ago, our president at the time signed it into law. And now what we get is we get local township police departments holding joint task force stings on prostitution rings under the guise of human trafficking under the Department of Homeland Security. And nobody but me seems to be all that upset about it. I don't quite understand what local issue like that has to do with the Department of Homeland Security. But okay, I'm not quite sure how that harms our security as a nation, but, you know, we gave them that power, right? Sad stuff. Anyway, when we come back, I talk with Luke Vargas, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
To hear Republicans and Fox News tell it, the Affordable Care Act is the coming of the apocalypse for untold millions of Americans with private market health insurance policies who are getting all those cancellation letters due to Obamacare. The truth, according to a careful new report from Families USA, is very different. Families USA's Ron Pollack.
The net result is that only a very tiny portion of the non-elderly population, less than 1% by our calculation, 0.6%, are at risk of losing their current individual health insurance market plan due to the Affordable Care Act, the overwhelming majority of people with private individual health insurance today will soon be able to receive better coverage and pay lower premiums due to the Affordable Care Act.
The Families USA report says 15.2 million Americans, 5.7% of the non-elderly population, have health insurance in the private marketplace rather than through employer-based group plans. Pollack says these are often Swiss cheese policies with big holes in coverage. The report found that 10.8 million of these people are income eligible for Affordable Care Act policies. Pollack says that means they will get more affordable, better insurance under the Affordable Care Act even if their current individual market policies are canceled. Put in perspective and in context, Obamacare benefits at least 90 million people, while just 0.6% of non-elderly Americans are at risk of losing unsubsidized coverage.
That number is a tiny fraction of the 65 million non-elderly people with pre-existing health conditions who will gain new protections through the Affordable Care Act. It is also a small fraction of the tens of millions of uninsured Americans who can also get help through new health coverage.
Registered nurses at Lawrence and Memorial Hospital in New London, Connecticut, say they won't be bullied by management threats to lock them out. The union nurses, represented by American Federation of Teachers Local 5049, say the lockout threat is just more of the same scare tactics from the corporation that runs the hospital. The 540 RNs and 250 LPNs want a new fair contract, including protections for patients and their families, as the corporation shifts services and caregiver jobs away from the hospital. The LPNs are members of AFT Local 5051. Both union locals have authorized strike action if necessary. The nurses say they hope to reach a mutual agreement, though, at the bargaining table without a strike. The nurses have filed unfair labor practice charges and have warned the hospital that a four-day work stoppage could begin as soon as Wednesday. As holiday gifts giving kicks into gear, don't forget Workers Independent News. Listener support helps sustain this newscast. Donate now at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I got to be honest, I hear one more person go, is it cold enough for you? I'm going to strangle them. Because, yeah, it's cold, but yeah, I'm tired of hearing about it already. And I keep wondering, you know, I had one guy today going, you know, where's that climate? Where's that global warming? Well, it's not global warming. It's climate change. And maybe it's why so quickly it got so obnoxiously cold. But anyway, here to talk about the most recent UN climate change conference, which was in Poland, our good friend Luke Vargas, Talk Radio News Service. Luke, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, good evening.
So the big climate change conference, did you figure out why it's cold all of a sudden here?
It certainly was a rude awakening. I went to Poland thinking that it was going to be kind of a winter wonderland. I love the country. I've traveled there in the summer a bunch of times. And because my itinerary included going to some national parks as part of a broad look at the environmental movement there, I was expecting, you know, a beautiful medieval forest covered in snow with bison roaming around, and it turned out it was about 50 degrees and rainy the whole time. So Seattle and Eastern Europe, kind of a letdown. It's freezing upon return.
Yeah, not doesn't sound all that great. So tell me about the conference. What did you find out? What was new? Anything exciting? Anything shocking?
Well, you know, one thing sort of procedural I found very interesting is that these talks, the press is very limited. And in their place, the NGO community has many, many seats at the table. And this caused, this is not maybe what you expected, but a very interesting dynamic in which you've got journalists sort of camped down in these dungeons of media centers, something you probably see going to you know, big political conventions and the like. And then you've got inside the negotiating room tons of NGO officials with cameras and Google documents open where they're basically live blogging all the events. They were put in the room as a gesture of understanding, saying, look, we don't want you to feel like you're being shut out of the process. And in fact, they're not there most often to even argue for much of a position. They're there to be media liaison. That was a little bit of a strange procedural note.
Even though as a media person you're there, they put you in a dungeon and you've got to get your information from a third party?
Well, I don't have to stay there.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, many people do because it's quite close and convenient when you want to go and try to talk to someone in the hallways. But when it comes to actually going in and being a part of the negotiation, the media is not allowed in. You can be escorted in, take a photo. And this is all very strange because the climate talk, I did a little informal media study before departing. And just a few years ago, 3 years ago, this is the yearly round of talks. And 3 rounds ago, there were 67 U.S. outlets that went and covered the talks. Now it's down to 20. They're getting more and more specialized. You don't have the big papers going anymore. You have climate-specific websites like Climate Wire and a bunch of other ones. And it's a, you know, it's really an open question about whether this is a good thing or not, because it's a vicious cycle in which the public is more and more not even made aware that these talks are going on. But the reality is that this is the highest level they're going to get. UN created this framework for these discussions to occur, and if there ever is going to be international movement on climate change, it's going to happen at these conferences. And if you make a determination from a bureau in D.C. or New York months in advance that it's not worth going, then you're not going to cover any, you're not going to be there to cover anything if it is to happen. So kind of strange being one of the few members of the American Press Corps that I know, a pretty large community that I saw over there.
Yeah, well, you know, really Americans don't really care about that stuff. They care about, you know, what's on reality TV or American Idiot and things like that. They don't care about climate. They don't care about that.
You know, it was an interesting weekend because not only in Warsaw, but a few hundred miles away in Geneva, you had two major negotiations coming to a close. And of all three, the Iranian issue, the Syrian peace talks, and then the global climate, saving the climate talks in Warsaw, by far. I mean, this is not even on a scale of magnitude. I would hear almost every radio broadcast that began while I was in Poland saying, and, you know, back in Europe, negotiations are continuing until the 11th hour, and I was, oh, I'm so excited. This might be about the talks that I'm at, and then it switched to Iran or the Syrian issue. So really taking a back page, and maybe for good measure, because hardly anything was agreed to, and this is starting to become worrisome, because the end of 2015 is the target date for a replacement treaty for the Kyoto Protocols, which are going out of existence in 2020. And the new agreement is going to be needed for that post-2020 world. We're running out of time.
Yeah. Are you surprised? Yeah. Are you surprised that nothing came out of this? Because I got to be honest with you, I'm not.
I'm not terribly surprised. It's also worth noting that this talk, these round of talks, were not meant to be high-level political talks. When the highest level, you know, only two presidents attending, two prime ministers attending. The U.S. negotiator is just the State Department appointee from the political department there. So to expect a political solution from a very non-political group of individuals, you know, I'm not surprised in that regard. But some of the arguments and the, you know, just how prevalent some of these very damaging arguments are that seem to just draw a division between country blocks, especially, I found it very amazing that after, you know, 20 years essentially since Kyoto negotiations first started, that so many countries are still in favor of viewing the world as developing versus developed. I understand from an economic standpoint there are some benefits to be had by being aware of such distinctions and the different trajectories of countries, but when it really comes down to just global responses to environmental and ecological challenges, which really are in their nature international, I found it very surprising that so many countries, China being one of the most vocal, were really advocating for countries to be, you know, considered very different. Essentially, developing countries wanting to blame developed countries for all the impacts of global warming, and thus sort of allowing developing countries, which can include China and India, which I think is sort of revealed to you the extent to which the system doesn't work.
Right. So basically saying... Basically saying that, you know, because the argument, as I understand it, you know, and the argument from, like, China's perspective as well, in the 50s, the U.S. was, you know, doing all this pollution in the 60s and 70s and all that, and we're just developing now, and we should be able to pollute like they did, seems to be a little short-sighted.
And particularly because the route of growth in many areas is incredibly rapid among developing countries is pretty quickly going to make them into the kind of polluters that even 20 years ago developed countries were described as. And in that type of growth, it involves major infrastructure, structural development, the creation of new forms of power generation. generation, which more often than not are not terribly clean. Those are the countries that really are at this window of opportunity to choose what their future is going to be. And if they don't feel like there's much political pressure to grow in a responsible way, then they will become the type of country before long that is now being criticized in these agreements, and that 20 years ago was being criticized. So the U.S. was ultimately successful in having some of those walls broken down, basically negotiating to have countries like the U.S. not necessarily viewed in legal terms as being culpable for all the effects of global warming. But despite the fact that those barriers are sort of being broken down in a linguistic sense, politically speaking, it was very contentious. I was just surprised how hostile different country blocks have remained with each other until the very end of negotiation. And, even if we weren't expecting a political agreement here, the extent to which there are, well, I would say, growing political divisions between groups of countries was very upsetting as we try to project 2 years down the road the fact that these countries will all need to come together and agree on something.
You know, I Rex Tillerson, the CEO of ExxonMobil, once said, and we use the clip quite often, that, you know, well, you know, all of this stuff, yeah, it's global climate change is real, it's the global warming is real, this is happening, and we're going to engineer our way out of it. We're going to adapt, basically. And, you know, when I hear you say this and how these countries are breaking down, I would have to wonder if the countries who are being most affected by the change in climate, if they're not the ones who are the most vocal and the ones who can't adapt because they don't have the resources to be able to adapt for their citizens, if they're not the most vocal in doing something, while countries like ours who, you know, we've got some bad things happening, but we're kind of adapting at some level, if that doesn't have a lot to do with it.
Yeah. Actually, one of the more interesting presentations I saw was from the California Department of Energy and the Environment, the EPA, essentially, out there. You know, I didn't expect a state delegation to be sending a bunch of folks out there. In fact, they were there in quite a strong contingent. And what they said was very interesting. California is one of the few states in the U.S. that has really kept its energy use per capita steady over the past few decades. And now citizens of California are using the same amount of energy per capita as they did in the 1970s, thanks part to a lot of regulation and efficiency improvements there. And so they've set a plan for where they want to be in 2050 with the environment and energy production. And they said, we're doing great. We're going to hit our 2030 interim targets. We're going to sail right past them because all of that involves just continuing regulations, the expansion of Tesla and other, you know, green forms of transportation. Again, basically engineering your way out of a problem.
Right.
But then they admitted, and they didn't admit, I brought it up to there were no American journalists in the room, a bunch of people nodding along with what they were saying. And can you guys comment on the fact that there is this report from the DOE and Berkeley released last week that said, sure, you're going to hit your 2030 targets, but you've thought of no new ways of generating power. You're taking your nuclear plants offline. The hydropower in California is being realized that it really can't continue. Not a good way of managing rivers in a very water scarce place. And they said, well, you're actually right. We are stuck. We don't know how to go this extra step. So we are running into this problem on a global scale. Is that efficiency is increasing. There are a lot of places that are finding better ways of improving energy usage. When it comes to generation, we're still stuck with the same old technologies. And unfortunately, so many countries, including Poland, they're at this point of needing to make decisions right now about economic growth. And the way they see it, they're not going to wait 5 years to decide what to do with their energy sector. So they build 12 new coal plants, as they're going to 12 new open-pit lignite coal mines in Poland in the next few years. In other countries, they're making the same determination. And unfortunately, we don't have the technology in power generation, at least in the eyes of many of these developing countries, that are competitive enough to make these countries think many decades down the line. So countries, unfortunately, as I detected in Warsaw, are really still not ready to start taking environmental concerns really into the picture. Development is by far, in a way, the top priority for so many of these negotiations.
Yeah, and what's interesting is the moneyed interests. You know, the big coal and gas and all of
sure.
those, they've got a vested interest in it not working. In fact, I had a guy the other day give me a whole dissertation on why coal-fired power plants are better for the environment and are greener than windmills. And I just
I will say that there was an international coal conference that was convened and actually hosted by the Department of the Economy in Warsaw while these talks were going on. I'm going to put up my Talk Radio News Service video report from Poland tomorrow. And I did travel out to the coal country there, interview a lot of activists, heads of national parks and stuff. And I have to say, Poland is unrepentant. It is going ahead with coal. They actually sacked their environmental minister during the conference and replaced him with a guy who, in his speech, again, 2 days before the talks, and he gave a televised speech in which he said, my top priority now is to exploit natural gas reserves, shale gas in this country as fast as possible within the next year. So this is a country that, again, is not even going to play American-style politics or PR management with this. They are unrepentant in saying that economic growth, not spending an extra dollar to try to factor in real costs of energy generation. It's not the way they're thinking right now. And, it leaves a journalist like me and someone who comes at this both as someone with Polish bloodlines, also someone who cares about the environment, in a difficult place because you don't want to start singling out countries necessarily or trying to catch up in their development, Poland especially, at a deficit. They are less developed than many of their neighbors, and they feel they need to try and catch up.
Right.
Do you criticize them, directly for just thinking about the energy solutions that are just at hand, or when do you begin to apply that pressure? And it's a difficult challenge that really hasn't been resolved by the world community.
Yeah, and that's where you would hope meetings like this one would have had some solutions. I did want to ask you. I got a couple minutes left, and I did want to ask about the big deal over the weekend. I'm sure you saw that we now have a deal with Iran. I'm not quite sure what all that means yet, but I was curious what your thoughts are.
Oh, well, I think what is really interesting here are the reactions to this. You've got Israel calling the agreement a historic mistake. In broad terms, what you've got is the United States easing sanctions, freeing up some international bank accounts of Iran's leaders, and in exchange, a sort of a temporary freeze on certain types of enrichment activity. All the details will be worked out later. But what I think is really important to remember here, because you are hearing a ton of very fiery rhetoric from a lot of different sides here, and this is something that the head of the Council of Foreign Relations said this morning, which is you've got to think about these kind of negotiations. And bear in mind, these parties haven't come together in 30 years.
Right.
This is not like we are negotiating all the time and have minor victories here and there. This is the first thing that could be considered anything of a victory in a decade.
And this is only a six-month deal, right?
Sure, but it is again, the first agreement
right.
of its type. You've got to look, you can't weigh this as what is possible versus what is ideal, which I guess would be the suspension of all nuclear activities in Iran. You have to look at what's possible versus the realistic alternative here. And I think when you begin to consider this deal under those frameworks, it's probably a good thing, particularly on inspection. Iran has agreed to have the IAEA,
right.
energy monitors there, the ability to go to any of the three major sites in the country on just less than a day's notice. They can come and stay for days. They can go every day they want for 6 months.
So do you think it's curious that it comes up now because Obama's got all of his Obamacare problems, as fake news on Fox is out there saying?
I don't. I think this is a product of John Kerry's style of leadership at the State Department. So there's a great Reuters profile on him today saying he's essentially a relentless pursuer of negotiations. And, if you look at this, he's brought Iran. He's got essentially an interim deal with the Iran nuclear program. You've got today the announcement of Geneva II peace talks for Syria. You've got movement on a plan for Afghanistan down the line. Now starting to take shape. So I think this is something that John Kerry has wanted. The U.S. has been negotiating with Iran. March, it was revealed, these secret talks that have been being held around the Middle East and Oman. Both of these countries seem to really want an agreement on the nuclear issue. So I would hesitate to say there's overtly political reasons for this news now. I think finally, I think the levee has just broken. That there was a desire for agreement, it seems, from both parties here. And we're starting to see the fruits of relentless negotiation.
And crippling sanctions.
They are beginning to be weighed. This is really what the Ayatollah wants. You know, some people were saying when we heard about the Syria negotiations beginning today that, oh, maybe this will be a sign that Iran is willing to break its ties with the Assad government. These are very different things. Right. The Ayatollah wants the end of sanctions for political convenience, but he's not going to drop his support for Assad. That is an ideological commitment. So, again, they really need those sanctions to ease the country. It's an absolutely unsustainable economic situation. So he's willing, perhaps to be stopped at the negotiating table, to be a thorn in the West side when it comes down to his ideological allies. I'm guessing that's what's probably going to happen at the Geneva talk on Syria in January, but at least on a purely economic negotiating front with the nuclear issue, he's a lot more flexible. I think that's sort of the message out of the two announcements from Geneva today.
All righty. Well, good. I think it's not a bad thing. I'm not going to say it's a great thing, but I can't see it being a bad thing. My whole life we've been dealing with Iran. I remember as a kid, I was in 7th, 8th grade, they were talking about going to war with Iran. So we'll see. Luke, it's always great talking with you. Appreciate the time.
You as well. Take care.
Luke Vargas, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the talk.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
Somehow I had a memory of learning in school that our Thanksgiving holiday was established by the pilgrims that came over on the Mayflower. But I discovered that President George Washington issued the first Thanksgiving proclamation on November 26, 1789. And thus began the long and winding path to whether and when America would celebrate the holiday. It would not be until the year 1956 that a final unified Thanksgiving Day would be established. The early presidents after George Washington were not particularly keen on declaring Thanksgivings, mostly because it was perceived as a New England or a Yankee tradition, and many of the early presidents were from Virginia. So it became somewhat of a regional celebration. And then came along New England novelist Sarah Hale. If there is a mother of Thanksgiving, it would be Ms. Hale. Join me next time to find out the results of Ms. Hale's efforts to establish a Thanksgiving holiday. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Guess what? The majority of the American people believe we should have a gold standard and not a paper standard.
Pink fluffy unicorns dancing on rainbows. Pink fluffy unicorns dancing on rainbows. Pink fluffy unicorns dancing on rainbows.
Check out the website, theRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@theRickSmithShow.com. So today, the year was 1983, and Canadian postal workers protesting the post office's decision to offer discounts to businesses, but not to actual individual customers. They announced that for 1 week they would unilaterally reduce postage by 2/3. Declared the Canadian Union of Postal Workers, members of the general public, not businesses, can mail letters with 10-cent postage, and postal workers will process them without taxing them for insufficient postage. The year was 1983, and good for them. That kind of worker class solidarity, I'm right there with. And, you know, the thing that gets me is I got an email from a listener who said, you know, we should be looking at the Postal Service as an amazing success story that even saddled with the massive poison pill that the Republicans rammed down their throats when they, in 2006, just of without any real thought. Well, that's not true. Lots of thought. Without any real thought of the workers, but the ideology of killing the post office passed through this idiotic piece of legislation under the guise of reform that would force the Postal Service to pre-fund the health care of all of their retirees for 75 years into the future, something no other employer or entity has ever had to do in the history of civilization. But the Postal Service, they're different. And oh, by the way, do it in the next 10 years. So, you know, that worker that isn't even born yet, who's going to need health care in 75 years? Yeah, yeah, you got to pre-fund their health care, their retiree health care. And, you know, as this email pointed out, the Postal Service would have actually made money had they not been saddled with this massive liability. Had they been, you know, just treated like anybody else, they would have made a substantial profit. That would have been, and here's the important part of this, and this is why it's important to remember that the destruction of the post office is about a couple of quick things. It's about the profit that can be made, and about the land, lots of land, huge land deal. But understand, the Postal Service has been making money. We've just been saddling them with really bizarre requirements. Now, that money that would have been profit, that excess, that surplus, if you will, would have then been poured back into the business, as I'm in favor of, poured back into the Postal Service to make it a better entity, not divvied up for shareholders to pocket. And that's where the radical right in this country, that's where the corporatists in this country who want to privatize and profitize everything, that's why they're appalled. That why should we have a postal service that takes that surplus and puts it back into the business when we could be pocketing that and buying our 7th or 10th home, like our governor, the second home in South Carolina, hopefully his retirement home. Yeah, we should be able to just pocket that. And the heck with the future. Interesting bit of history. I mean, I'm always fascinated to read what happens on days like today. Also, today back in history, teachers, they went on strike in St. Paul, Minnesota. The first ever organized walkout by teachers in the country. The month-long strike for better schools involved about 1,100 teachers there in the St. Paul, Minnesota area, and principals as well, which led to a number of reforms in the way schools were administered and operated. The year that happened, 1946. And as I read more into it, as I looked deeper into it, it was about making sure that schools had adequate funding, adequate number of books, desks, all about things for the kids in their education. Seems kind of eerily familiar. I mean, look at what's going on in Philadelphia. What those teachers are complaining about is we don't have guidance counselors. We don't have nurses. We don't have adequate facilities to educate. It's very rarely about themselves. Anyway, interesting bit of today in history. If you've got any thoughts, questions, comments, whatever is on your mind, you can always email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Our podcast on the website, where you can go if you missed any portion of the program, Stitcher, where you can get the podcast to put on your smartphone, take with you where you want to go. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to talk a little bit about the transportation bill. Didn't get around to it today. So Obamacare, I want to pick up on that, as the right in the country is not all through too thrilled, but thrilled that they got a talking point to attack him over. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy is coming.